Feel free to look around at the artwork and everything, and we're going to get started here in about 5 minutes, okay? Thank you. Good morning, everyone. If you'll find a seat, please. We can get started. Good morning. I'm David Pearson. I'm the moderator of the Cambria Fire Safe Focus Group that's putting on this event today. First of all, I would like to thank a couple people for their monetary support. This is not an inexpensive thing that we do every year. First of all, Supervisor Gibson's office gave us a nice grant. Thank you, Supervisor. And a bulk of our money comes from the Fire Safe Council of San Luis Obispo County, of which I am on the board of directors. That is an organization that is doing a lot of work in and around Cambria. If you stick around for the last speaker, he'll talk about some of the work that's being done, grant work. They just recently got a grant for $6.7 million to do more forest health work in and around Cambria. So it's great news for us, great news for us. All right, I'd like to start off. I'd like to start off with the awarding of the prizes for the poster contest that we had. Roberta, would you like to come forward, please, with the art teacher from the high school, Suzette Morrow. And Chris Langren, thank you.
All right. This is our second student poster contest. And this year, we decided to focus on Coast Union students. We wanted to find out what they think about fire safety and fire prevention. So we teamed up with Suzette Morrow, our art teacher at Coast Union. And she and her art students got to work, and the result is what you see in this room and in the other room. Our judges worked hard to reach agreement on 8 of the entries. We had 41 in total. And we can also display the 4 feet by 8 feet posters that will be on display around town. So you will want to be sure that you see those, and there's 4 more in the other room as well. And we want to thank Sign Here and the Fire Safe Council for making these large signs possible. They're so beautiful, and the colors. And I wanted to ask Suzette Morrow to announce the winners, and we hope that they're willing to come up so we can all congratulate all of them. And one more thing, I want to thank Chris Landgreen and Joyce Renshaw for being such great helpers. It takes a village to do this kind of thing. It really does. Okay, Suzette.
First of all, I wanted to thank Bob Putney for coming out to talk with the students and the firefighters that did a wonderful demonstration for the high school students on what it looks like when fire has an oxygen traveling in by taking doors on and off of a little dollhouse that they made. So they created real fire and then showed how it spread. The students were able to see that, and it kind of kicked off our beginning of our making of the fire safety posters and their study on how fire happens and what ways fires start. So the students, I just want to explain real quick, they are high school students, and normally we think about fire safety happening in elementary school and students then being raised with that education that they get in elementary school. But it's really also important for middle school and high school students as they get older and they have different types of lifestyles, experiences, things that they want to be aware of that maybe at elementary school they don't know. So we found that this education was extremely helpful. When the students picked what type of fire problem we have in our community or in our world, and then they researched it, they had more questions about it. And the more questions that they had about it, the more they wanted to research. So the cycle of that happening shows you really how important it is for students to do things with art. It's an inclusive thing. It's not just about art. It's about learning about all the things that in life, right, we figure out how we internalize it, synthesize it, and then put it into our own unique, completely unique, right, way of showing others what we learned. So in some ways, the billboards here and the posters are ways for us to share in our community and people who are traveling through our town what our unique experiences are with fire safety. But it's also a huge learning experience that is displayed for all people to see, how that student learned from a topic that we can all feel better about and safer about. So I want to encourage everybody really to celebrate not only that the students have shared with you ways to be more safe in our community, but also that they've been brave enough to research something, spend weeks trying to figure out how to show you what they're learning, and then actually having a huge billboard with their work on it is an artistic leap of faith that everyone is going to like their work, right? We're all our own worst critics. And in some ways, taking a little tiny piece of paper of your idea and blowing it up into a 4-foot by 8-foot giant thing for everyone in the community to see was a big ask. So they went on this journey with me and trusted that everybody was going to enjoy what they made. And whether they had theirs turned into a billboard or not, they know that they're all up here and that the whole community is here looking at their artwork and what they felt was important for us to know about what they saw fire safety looking like. Some of them chose household dryer fires. Some of them chose smoking cigarettes. Some of them chose campfires. But they're all that student's unique decision about what they thought was a way that we could prevent people from making some of these errors that caused fires in our community. And a big, big shout out to Emily, who gave us a list of things that we could learn about, and the firefighters who came out, because they put a lot of preparation into helping us get this going. But I hope in the future that we can build on our whole educational system at school, learning about fire safety and not just focusing on the younger ages, but middle school, high school, what we're doing here, more of that, and really getting more of a level of understanding about the multiple ways that fires can be started. We had students who actually wanted to know, how do fireworks make fires? So if those are some of the questions that we're asking as a 17-year-old, then you can imagine that we are all in some ways needing to know more about what we can do in our own community. So with that, I really hope that you guys will give a very, very loud applause and cheer for these really brave students who are here today, that see their giant work, know it's going to go up in the community, and that all of the people that are here around you have helped make that happen. So it was a super important time for them. All right. So our first person that has gotten her poster made into a billboard today is Liliana Cisneros. Would you come on up, Liliana? Great. She's actually won a few things this year, so she's a superstar. Lexi, are you here, Lexi? I didn't see you come in. Lexi, come here. There she is. Hi, Lexi. Come on up. If you didn't see Lexi's billboard out there, it's the one with the candle and the Kleenex. That was, yeah, really important. We were all talking about how cats knock things over and things can happen with stuff on your nightstand, so that was awesome. And then Akabi P, if her Does grandma or grandpa want to come up and stand up for her so she can know that you are representing her? Thank you. Awesome. Okay, and then Catherine Mercado. She did a beautiful job as well. Okay, and Mr. Carlos Chavez. Carlos is right up front and is in Spanish for us. There you go. Thank you. And then Marisol Pena. Awesome. Great. Marisol's is in the other room, and it has used a salt technique with watercolor that is showing the smoke that from somebody stomping out a cigarette. So if you don't have if you haven't seen it, it's kind of right by the door over there. And then the last one is Diego Alvarez. Thank you, Mr. Diego. All of these students here. Oh, is Derek here today? Derek, are you here? Okay, Derek Quintero is also the one that's got the fireplace over there, but he couldn't make it today. All of these students, though, have worked really hard, researched their topics, created multiple sketches before they created their drawing for you, and then decided which media they wanted to use that would best depict what they wanted to say with this piece. So thank you all for your excellent work on this project.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Great job by all of the children at the high school. You notice in the back, we have all of the posters that they did, all 41. And the 8 that are blown up, there's 4 here, and then of course 4 in the other room. Those 8 will be rotated around signpost that we have in town. There's 2 signs at the fire station back to back. There's 1 at Main and Highway 1 as you come into town. And then the other one is in the famous Spaghetti Bowl. Okay. And those will take the place of the ones that have been going and that have been up there, which were from the elementary and middle school from last year. We've also got word that the Fire Safe Council may take some of these and spread them around the county. So you may get more publicity than you thought you would. So that's great news. All right, moving along, I'm going to invite the next topic is fire insurance. Anybody interested in fire insurance these days? It's become a real issue in Cambria and throughout California, and we are really privileged today to have Joe Locker with us today from the United Policyholders Organization, which is a consumer advocate organization that works a lot on insurance issues. Joel worked as a commercial insurance underwriter before joining the California Department of Insurance in 1985. Starting as a market conduct examiner, he went on to become the division chief of market conduct and of consumer services, deputy commissioner of rate regulation, and then finally, before retiring, he was the chief deputy commissioner for Commissioner Dave Jones. So he knows a little bit about insurance and about how insurance works in the state of California. He is proud now to work for the United Policyholders, a nonprofit that helps consumers with an array of insurance issues. So Joel should be up here shortly, and I've got to get his presentation. Right. We need to promote Joel, or how do I need to do that? Okay, Joel, you should be able to go ahead and speak.
Yeah, I thank you for having me. Hopefully you can all hear me. Yes? Are you able to hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, I'm just waiting for my presentation to go up. I'm sorry that anyone feels that they should listen to an insurance presentation at any point in time, but that's kind of the times that we are in today, that insurance is something that has become a focus and an issue for a lot of families. I'll get started as soon as my presentation appears on the screen and you don't have to look at my face any longer. There we go. Okay. All right, I will begin. Thanks everybody for being here. I'm gonna kind of run through the basics about homeowners insurance, why you need it, you know, a little bit about this challenging market. And, you know, insurance is a critical component of our lives, even though we often resent paying that premium. You know, I've seen, I go to many events, post-catastrophe events, to help people work through their insurance claims. And, you know, of course, every time they're grateful for the coverage they did have, often wish they had more, because it's something we kind of put aside most of the time. And, you know, odds are any one of us will never need to use our insurance, which is great. But, you know, it's something that we should all know something about. This is the most challenging insurance market I've ever seen during my 40 plus years in insurance. So let me tell you a little bit about what I think you should know. Next slide, please. So United Policyholders is a nonprofit started after the Oakland Tunnel Fire to help people with their claims issues. Been doing that ever since, and I'm grateful to get to work there. Next slide, please. The issue today is about homeowners insurance. A lot of non-renewal notices going out from many major insurers who we never expected would have an issue writing more coverage. And for those of you who are non-renewed, there's a challenge finding insurance. And for all of us, we're finding that insurance is a lot more expensive than it was just a few years ago. Double-digit increases, sometimes triple-digit increases for some homeowners in California. Next slide, please. So there are ways that you can make it so fire insurance is easy to get. If you can only do this around your home, I think you'll find no problem finding coverage. But if you're unable to do this, we'll continue with the slides. Next slide, please. So one thing I always want to emphasize, despite the fact that coverage is expensive, you really want to avoid being significantly underinsured. We find after these wildfire events that often about as many as 80% of people are underinsured by significant amounts. And of course, that makes a major impact on your ability to rebuild your home. So I always suggest that people should get an idea of how much per square foot it would cost in their region to build a home. I can tell you myself that my insurance company sends out, as they are required to do every other year, a informational page in your homeowner's renewals that tells you how they've estimated the cost to rebuild your home. It's going to detail labor and materials, overhead and profit, demolition and debris removal, and permits and architect's plans. So it looks like it's a very thorough evaluation. But even with all that, those numbers tend to be very inadequate to rebuild a home. For example, they might come out to about $300 a square foot in many communities. And I think you'll find today that $300 a square foot isn't going to rebuild a home almost anywhere in California. Of course, construction prices have surged. So in a time when premiums are going up, it's hard to convince people to want to increase their limits, but at least check it out and make sure you are in the range of reasonable in terms of where your coverage limit is for your home and the ability to be able to rebuild it should you have a total loss. Next slide, please. Another thing insurers require, if you were to suffer a total loss, which hopefully, of course, you never, ever will, but in order to claim your contents limits, you basically have to list every single thing in your home, when you purchased it, what condition it was in, when it was destroyed, how much you paid for it. The insurer will depreciate it, give you that amount, and then when you replace it, you get the replacement cost. It's a very trying process and challenging when, you know, it's if you lose everything. The other thing you could do is prepare by having an inventory where you write down everything you own. Most people really don't want to do that in advance of a loss. So at the very least, I suggest that you go through and video the contents of your home with your phone or an iPad, walk through your home, open all your drawers, your cabinets, your closets, having evidence of, you know, just how many things you own and what they are can greatly ease the claims process should you ever need to go through that for any reason, right? And it doesn't have to be a total loss. It could be a flood or, you know, some fire in part of your home. So create an inventory, at least on video, of the things you own. It can make the insurer understand, okay, yeah, I see you own these things, and sometimes not make you go through the whole depreciation and then repurchase and process again. Next slide, please. So again, many people currently being non-renewed in California, that requires a 75-day notice by the insurer if they make that decision. The point of those 75 days is to allow you to shop around for new coverage, or if it's an issue that caused the non-renewal that you can correct, you can get to work on that. Now, for example, it can be that you have a wood-shake roof, and possibly if you're able to replace that with a composite roof, you can reverse that non-renewal. But at the very least, you want to get shopping for new coverage as soon as you can, because it is a real challenge to find insurers writing coverage, especially in any area subject to wildfire risk in California or actually throughout the country at this point. And you should know that there are a lot more insurers that write coverage than you can probably just name, you know, offhand. And any one local agent probably only represents 5 or 6 insurers of the 60 insurers that may write residential coverage in California. So ask each agent that you contact which companies they represent and if, you know, which ones turned you down, so that you can make sure that you check with every available insurer before you would ever settle for a fair plan policy. Next slide, please. So one great source of information for shopping the market is the Department of Insurance's website. There's a page there called Top 10 Tips. It has an insurance finder tool. And it also has a list. There's a list of those in those tips of the 800 number for every insurer that writes residential coverage in California. You can call that 800 number and either ask for a quote if they write directly or ask for a referral to an agent that represents them close to your community or wherever in the state of California. Because you really want to go through that whole list of insurers that write coverage before settling for a fair plan policy, which is both very limited coverage and very expensive coverage. So use these tools to do a thorough search of the homeowners insurance market. Next slide, please. So again, you know, if you do all that and you still end up with a fair plan policy, it's important to understand that that is the most basic of property insurance. It's simply a fire policy. And it's really there to satisfy a mortgage requirement, but it really doesn't provide any of the critical coverages that a homeowner's policy provides other than the fire peril. So you have to pair that policy with what's called a difference in conditions policy or a DIC to approximate the coverage of a homeowner's policy. Next slide, please. That difference in conditions policy includes coverage for things like water damage or theft and liability. Water damage is the after fire is water damage is the second most common cause of major losses. Broken plumbing line or such floods the home, does major damage to the home. Liability coverage, your liability for someone injured on your property is a coverage that has a low frequency, you know, it doesn't occur very often, but it can have there can be significant cost if you don't have a liability policy in the chance that somebody, you know, injures themselves somehow on your property. You definitely want to have liability policy. So a DIC is pretty critical coverage that everyone should have if they end up with a fair plan policy. Next slide, please. So the fair plan policy, again, unlike a homeowner's policy, is bare bones even within the coverages that it does include. So for the contents coverage, you have to add things like vandalism coverage. The fair rental value coverage is very limited. You'll want to bump that up at least to the 20%, because if there is a fire and you do have to be out of your home or have to rebuild, it takes a long time to get a home rebuilt in a wildfire area. 2-3 years, unfortunately, is kind of the minimum. You want to increase your building code upgrade coverage. That the automatic built-in component of a fair plan policy for building code upgrade is very limited. Same for debris removal and other structures. So when you get that, if you do get a fair plan policy, you need to bulk up the coverages that come with that policy to have a really responsive policy. Next slide, please. So one good thing about the FAIR Plan recently is that they have added discounts for home hardening, both actions that you take to fortify the home itself and for the surrounding landscape that you own. These are the same exact actions that are mandated for all homeowners insurance. The only difference for the FAIR plan is that you have to do either all the dwelling ones or all the landscape ones to get that set of discounts for either one. For a homeowner's policy, if you do any of these actions, you can get a discount for each single one that you do. So you don't have to do them all to get the full discounts. So these are things like the Class A roof, the 6 inches above your ground level before your combustible siding begins, ember-resistant vents, the upgraded dual-pane windows and enclosed eaves, and the vegetation management of your property. Next slide, please. So one thing to note about, I tell you a little bit about how insurance rates work. Probably a little more than a decade or more ago, insurers started using satellite imagery as a way to score properties in terms of wildfire risk. And then those scores made a big difference in both eligibility for coverage and how much a person was going to pay. So before that, you know, probably everyone in the same zip code and fire protection class would probably pay pretty much the same thing. But when these were introduced, there were pretty radical differences between what people paid and whether they got coverage. And in this example, which is, you can see satellite image of the Cambria region, the home on the left that is in the middle of that circle, you can't even see it or see anything about it, but that's what the satellite is detecting, is likely to have a better wildfire score and higher level of eligibility than the home on the right side, which is closer to more vegetation and also probably on a greater slope than the property on the left. So this was kind of a game changer in insurance rates and underwriting. That has changed a little bit lately. Next slide, please. It's gotten even more detailed. So those same models or models still measure those same components of slope and vegetation, but now they get a much more detailed picture of the specific home being evaluated. And you can see in this picture that the insurer is able to identify that there are trees growing, that tree branches reach out over the roof of the property. In fact, these new models take in a lot of data. Of course, it can also see whether or not you have defensible space around your home, but it also loads in information about the address, such as where, what year the home was built. So it generally knows the building codes in place at the time. It can see and sense what type of roof you have. For example, if you still have a wood shingle roof, that by telling what year your home was built, it will know the kind of vents that were required for construction at the time of the home being built. So it knows that if a newer home was built, that it has the ember-resistant vents. If you've put in ember-resistant vents since you're, you know, yourselves, you need to report that to your insurer. But this is just an idea of how insurance has changed to more heavily scrutinize basically each home that is written. Next slide, please. And again, here, you may have heard State Farm a few months ago got a 20% rate increase approved. And I just put this slide in here so that people understand how that works. You know, how does everybody get a 20% rate increase then? That's not how it works. The 20% isn't basically the overall average. And here on this slide, I've pulled up one of the zip codes for your area. And it shows the number of policies that State Farm rights in your zip code, the actual average increase that was applied where you live. So this was some good news that on average, your increase was lower than State Farm's overall average. An average dollar increase, it was $144. The maximum increase anyone in your zip code received was $619. Now, again, that 9.9%, that's an average also. So it doesn't mean somebody couldn't have received a 30% increase while someone received a 5% increase, right? So these flow out differently. I showed a nearby zip code just, you know, to give you an idea of how each zip code experiences kind of a different overall experience. You can see the zip code for San Luis Obispo there. Their increase still was under 20%, but was almost double the increase average in your community. And just as another example, I threw in one, you know, we all have heard of, beautiful place, Big Sur. Their average increase was 48.7%. So again, an average, meaning somebody probably received much more than a 48% increase, while other homes there experienced a lower amount. But somebody's premium there went up $14,752. Presumably, that was a high-value home, I'm hoping, and not somebody's standard home. But you can see that the things, you know, things about your community and about your home can make a huge difference in how much, you know, an overall increase plays out for any given home. Next slide, please. So again, to reiterate, please make sure your dwelling limits are adequate. You want to make sure that you, if you have valuable things such as art, jewelry, business property, those all have limits in the policy called sublimits that cap how much you'll get for any one of those. So if you have very valuable art or jewelry, such as some of the homeowners that have that beautiful art that was on display earlier today, you might want to raise your limits to account for that, you know, valuable art, jewelry, or the business property you have on your residential property. And of course, always know that earthquake coverage, earth movement, those things are not covered by a standard homeowner's policy, flood insurance either. Those require separate coverages. Next slide, please. So one thing I always want to recommend to folks, many of us purchase our coverage, keep the same insurer for many years. So maybe when you purchased your coverage, you chose a $500 deductible because that seemed like a lot in 1975 or 1980. When you bought your home, but you want to greatly increase that deductible. Not only will it save you money, but you really don't want to make claims for any small amounts on your homeowner's coverage. It just draws negative attention to your home at renewal time. So adopt and contact your agent and implement a deductible that's as high as you can reasonably withstand to absorb of a loss. You know, maybe you can absorb a $10,000 loss. That will reduce your premium. And again, you really don't want to make small claims if you can avoid it anyway. And ask about any other discounts that your insurer offers. For example, every insurer has to offer those mitigation discounts. If you've done some of those, and I'm guessing this community and members of this group have done that, make sure you're reporting each of those actions to your insurer So you get the accompanying premium reduction that comes with those discounts and those actions. Next slide, please. And again, you know, these are the mandatory discounts every insurer has to give, Firewise USA being an important one. Next slide. The things that you do around your home, Class A roof, enclosed eaves, fire-resistant vents and multi-pane windows, the 6 inches non-combustible vertical clearance at the bottom of your outside walls. Each one of those is worthy of a discount, and that's mandatory for every insurer. Next slide, please. And then there are the property mitigation. You probably know all these, but you know, obviously it's removing combustibles as far away from your home as you can or as you control. Next slide, please. So one thing I would ask is if you, this gives our organization more information about what's going on in our state. And, you know, I love being here to reach out to you and make this presentation. I would ask in return, you take our California Home Survey at uphelp.org. UPHelp, of course, is United Policyholders. I tried to move through this quickly because we're talking about insurance, and I want to answer any of the questions you have after this. So thank you for your attention. The next slide, please. And know that at our website, the United Policyholders website, there's a lot of great information as well about all these things that we just discussed. Next slide, please. We have a county by county page of help that may be available, or details of businesses or issues or events happening in your county that you might take a look at. Next slide, please. The state has disaster ready materials available through its Listos organization, listoscalifornia.org. So check that out. Next slide, please. And again, United Policyholders has lots of materials. We're here to help. And I'm here to answer any questions you may have. So thank you. And I'll open up any questions that anyone might have in the audience about any insurance issues.
First of all, before we get to your questions, which I'm sure you have a few, the information that he talked about, some of the UP information is on a table in the other room. Okay, you can pick up some of that information that will guide you through getting insurance if you're not renewed. Okay, all right, questions? Anyone? Yes, sir. You need to speak into the microphone because otherwise it won't get recorded, okay? Which we are recording this entire thing, and it will be available on Slow Span on Monday, I believe. Yes? Monday on Slow Span? Yes. Okay.
You had mentioned that getting the California basic coverage really is inadequate, that you can get that supplemental policy, D something, you had an acronym. Is that very hard to get, though, too? Would it ensure, say, well, you've got this basic coverage because nobody else wants you, we're not going to give you the supplemental as well? How difficult is it to get that?
Yeah, on the Department of Insurance website, there is a listing of insurers that will provide that difference in conditions policy. So there's a specific link to those. I think there are maybe about 15 insurers. They do have some underwriting guidelines as well, but they're not related to wildfire because they're not offering that coverage in that particular part of the policy. The underwriting issues might be more about if you've had any kind of plumbing or water loss, but generally, I think most people qualify for the DICs if there are no particular issues at their property. But there are 12, 15 carriers that do write that coverage.
All right, another question. Yes, ma'am.
Just a quick question. How could we get a copy of your PowerPoint?
Yeah, I think at least this video is going to be available to you.
Yes, and I can get a copy of the PowerPoint. If you signed in and left your email address there, I will send it out to everyone that left their email so that you'll get all of the PowerPoints that we're going to have today, okay? Next question. Anyone? Yes.
Joel, thank you very much for this. And I have one question regarding what's happening in California with the Department of Insurance and what Ricardo Lara and his team with the new, I guess, strategic, I forget what it's called, insurance proposal that he has. What is the status of that? And if you could briefly describe maybe UP's perspective on how that might help with our situation. Thank you.
Yeah, I think he's calling it something like the Sustainable Insurance Initiative.
Right.
And it has two major components, one of which he had a workshop for recently, which is allowing insurers to use wildfire risk models that would project what an insurer's losses are likely to be based on input of a variety of data points about, you know, how often fires occur and where they occur. So the current rating system or rate making process requires that insurers only use their own loss experience to develop what their future losses will be. And that is problematic, but I would say the reason that's been used is because wildfire model projections can also be problematic in that they can, there can be an array of results depending on which modeler the insurer chooses. So the likelihood is that insurers' rates are going to go up. That's why they favor using the models. So there are issues with the current process, but I think there are going to be problems with the future as well. The other component of that initiative is to allow insurers to pass their reinsurance costs on to the policyholder. California law currently does not allow insurers to pass on that expense. I do believe that it is realistic to pass on some of that expense to consumers, but personally, and this is me personally, I don't know, United Policyholders is completely taking a position on this. I would cap how much that amount could be to a certain amount and not simply allow them to be a pass-through. The commissioner's choosing this path, which will allow premiums to go up with, you know, giving up some level of affordability to achieve better availability, right? This is what he's hoping to seek, and it is definitely a challenging market. And so, you know, it's not easy to make this, you know, balance out perfectly. I would be concerned that the two steps are too open-ended. You know, insurance isn't really available if it becomes unaffordable either. So, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. Maybe he'll temper what he's going to do in some way. But that's where he's headed. He's allowing a couple things insurers want. And there is some logic to why they want them. Definitely, but it's a little open-ended right now on how much he's allowing.
What is the timetable for that, Joel? Sorry, just real quickly.
Sure. He just had a workshop, you know, discussing the first step, the models. I think that was just like a thing that the input won't stop, that it's just going to roll forward anyway. So the issue is it will take, I'd say, probably at least a year before those rates or those model projections can be reviewed, put into a rate filing, and then approved. So, you know, it could be even a year and a half before we're seeing those impacts. But it is possible that even once it's established that that is the path forward, insurers may ease up a little, having achieved one of their goals, which is breaking through the current department regulatory process. And so that's just part one. And then the part two, the reinsurance, that probably is quicker. But again, it could be 2 years before we're seeing the full impacts of these things.
Thanks.
If I might, for Joel's benefit, Joel, I'm Bruce Gibson. I'm the Second District County Supervisor, proud to represent the community of Cambria. And this year, I have the honor of being the president of the California State Association of Counties. That's a group that represents all 58 of California counties, and we are strongly into advocacy on a wide variety of issues, wildfire insurance or insurance, homeowners insurance in general, and its availability and the problems with non-renewal are top of our list. First of all, I want to thank Joel so much for this presentation. And I will have our CSAC, as we call it, State Association staff, reach out to United Policyholders. I didn't see us there as a sponsor of this organization, but the information you have here is huge. Let me just give you, for the folks in the room, let me just give you a little bit of a report that this, as I said, is a high priority issue area at the state level. And the complexity of insurance regulation is, you know, that would seriously put you to sleep. But there's action working in the legislature. The legislature, of course, has been besieged. This is a problem all over the state. And I can tell you also that the officers of CSAC met directly with the governor about 3 weeks ago. And we know from his comments at that meeting that it is an extremely high priority with the governor to push this forward, because the amount of non-renewal here, the cost of insurance is skyrocketing, you know, amount of non-renewal is skyrocketing, the cost is skyrocketing, it is a bad situation all over the state. One of the key issues that we stressed with him, and I think that he understands, is that when homeowners take action to protect themselves against fire risk in particular, that they should be rewarded. And I know Joel obviously knows a lot more about the details of that, but it's my understanding, and Joel, correct me if I'm wrong, that the discounts available on insurance are not uniformly available through all carriers and to all areas of the state. And it is a really high priority for our state association that if a homeowner goes to the trouble and the expense of hardening their home, that should be rewarded, both in terms of the level of the policy and also fundamentally at the availability of the policy. So just wanted you to know that this is a hot topic of conversation in Sacramento. I expect that there will be some actions within the legislature over the course of this legislative session. So stay tuned on into the summer and we'll see what happens. So anyway, again, Joel, thank you so much for being here to present.
Oh, yeah, thank you. And that was great news. Thank you. I would say one of the pieces of legislation that's moving forward is requiring that any of these wildfire risk models that are going to be used recognize major mitigation actions, such as shaded fuel breaks or controlled burns that communities are doing to reduce the likelihood of the spread of wildfire. But I also want to mention that in that PowerPoint, you'll see the list of mandatory discounts that every insurer has to offer, you know, for each one that you do. And I will say that, you know, every insurer has filed to implement those discounts. A few insurers haven't gotten their filing approved yet through the Department of Insurance, but probably 2/3 of insurers are now offering those discounts. And every insurer will probably by the end of this year. So you want to make sure your agent or you report directly to your insurer for every one of those actions that you've taken at your home. And unfortunately, you know, to the point there, doing all these things can get you a discount, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be eligible at any given insurer. So you can do all the work and still find you're in the FAIR plan where you will get the discounts. But I think this is where it's important that community-wide actions take place, because that's going to have even bigger impacts, of course, on the likelihood of fire reaching your home, right? It is, you know, why many of you are in a FireWise community. Herd immunity, community actions, those are great. And I got to thank you, every one of you who does something at your property is doing a favor for your neighbor's property by reducing each other's likelihood of loss. So we'll continue taking questions.
Hi, Joel. Thank you so much for the information you're providing. It translates to many dollars savings in our community. I'm wondering, it sounds like all insurances are so different that it might not be possible to do this, but I'm wondering if there's a list or a calculator type of tool that would help us prioritize where to spend our money toward home gardening, such as is it best to replace your vents or is it better to change your landscaping, et cetera?
Yeah, I would say that because these are kind of introductory discounts, for many of them, it really varies from one insurer to the next, and of course, from one action to the next. The most critical of them, luckily, is one that probably most of you already have in place, and that's a Class A roof. But I think there's been a lot of focus on both ember-resistant vents and gutter guards for, you know, the gutters, rain gutters around the home. I think those are key. And then the other thing is that 5 feet around the home of non-combustible materials or vegetation, that's one of the biggest challenges many of us face, because, you know, we have our beloved, you know, plants and flora or whatever, and it is difficult to remove it all, but you know, it's those immediate things. And if you watch one of the IBHS videos, the Institute for Business and Home, whatever, insurance, I forget what it is, but watch their video that you see that fire blows in as embers and generally approaches through the vents and through a collecting of non-combustible materials at the bottom of the home. So those vents, the roof, gutter guards, and right around the home are where I'd focus.
All right. I'd like to thank Joel again very much for a very good talk. We'll now offer some local expertise on how to move your home to a more insurable home, okay? I don't know if I should introduce Bob or not. You know, everybody knows Bob. He's the former Cambria fire chief. He's worked with different California agencies all over. Bob is the Cambria FireWise USA community representative, and we thank him for that. He's the one that collects all the information, sends it off so that we can all get that discount, which is generally 5%, okay? I get that discount. If you don't get that discount, you ought to be asking your insurer, why don't I get that discount? Because everybody in Cambria, everybody in our zip code is eligible to get that because of the fine work of this man right here, okay? He collects the data, he sends it in, he gets the certificate for us, and the certificate is out on the CCSD website, or if you can't find it out there, you can email me and I'll send it to you. Okay. So Bob's going to talk a little bit about home hardening as soon as I can figure out how to get his presentation up. Okay.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for hanging around. I'm going to do something different this year. I'm going to do some of the things that you can start out with. Last year, I did home hardening, and I talked about the big ticket items. And I saw a lot of you in here, your eyes rolled back. A couple of you look like you're about ready to have a seizure or pass out. Because when you talk about replacing the siding around your house, you talk about replacing all of the vents, you talk about replacing your windows, your skylights, and putting a Class A roof on, you could be looking at $75,000 to $200,000, depending on your house and where you're located. And for some people, that's not sustainable. So I want to talk about the little things and make sure you understand what it really takes to harden a home. And I want to point out some of the misconceptions that are out there, because there are a lot of them. So unfortunately, you all know where we live, and we live in a Mediterranean climate, kind of not so different than Australia, New South Wales, Italy, Spain. You know, we get a wet, windy winter, sometimes longer than others. We're blessed to have a long winter this year, and you go, yay, but when all that fuel dries out, oh boy. So then we have that issue. Then we get long, dry, hot summers. So what grows here? The natural vegetation and some of the invasives that were brought in by the settlers who came here in the 15, 16, 1700s. Are European and other plants and things that don't belong here that are invasives, and they're used to going a long period of time without moisture. How do they do that? They have resin, tar, whatever you want to call it. The composition of the plant allows them to reflect the heat generated by the sun, and it allows them not to lose the water vapor that's within the plant. That makes them very oily, resin-y, like gasoline or diesel fuel, and they burn very aggressively. Unfortunately, our pine trees do that as well, but they are native here. So we need to be aware of that and realize that maybe even some of the shrubs and plants around our homes, maybe they're too close, maybe we need to replace those. And I will tell you that not all of the nurseries, not all of the people who are certified gardeners or that will design your home, they may not know how fire-resistant plant it is. So I would suggest you not use one source, but multiple sources to make sure you're not putting the wrong plant or tree around your home. There's lots of different types of fuel, and most people don't think, I hope you all think that your home is fuel, and you can see that here on this slide, but your lawn furniture is fuel. This picture you see up here of this beautiful picture of the coast and the hills, that's over in Templeton looking over towards our coast. All that grass fire fuel over there, when it gets burning and gets really rolling, creates a thermal cloud that carries those embers way up in the air. And those embers can travel 50, 100, 200 miles and then drop out of the sky all over your property. So when we had the resort fire up in Lake Nacimiento, I know that the fire service here, CAL FIRE, everybody was worried about embers coming over from that fire when the wind changed direction, dropping embers here and getting new fire starts. And as you will learn, if you haven't learned anything else in any other presentations today, I hope you'll learn that is the embers that is your enemy. And you need to protect against those embers, because there's not a few of them, there's a ton of them. So what kind of ingredients do we have, for wildfire? Well, most people think there's three variables, but there's four. One of the jokes we had in the fire service, I know my fire service friends that are in the room here will laugh. I think in 1973, when I joined the fire service, I think one of the captains that I was working for said, this is going to be the worst fire season ever. I retired in 2008, and in 2008, we were talking about this is the worst fire season ever. So I think this year will probably be the 102nd year of the worst fire season ever. But you need four things for that to happen, and that's fuel, and we have plenty of that. Some of it's native, some of it's non-native. Fortunately, your Fire Safe Council, your Fire Safe Focus Group, you folks, a lot of other people, a lot of private nonprofits and everything are going out and doing a lot of understory work and things like that to get rid of the fuels that have accumulated on the ground floor under our beautiful forest and even to the point of thinning our forest so that we don't have 15 trees in a 100-foot spot because they're not all going to survive. They're going to fall to the ground and become fuel. Weather, we have that, especially later in the year. We have hot, dry weather. We have high temps, low relative humidity, dry winds. The winds that really bother us mostly are the what we call, some people call them the phone winds or NorCal winds. Those are the winds that come off the Central Valley from the north, blow over this way, and blow offshore. So everything's going out over the ocean. The other ones are the Santa Anas, which come from the Orange County, San Bernardino, that basin, and blow up this way and blow offshore. When that's happening, as a firefighter, when I got up in the morning and we had those conditions, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. And if I was off duty that day, I got my gear and I told my family, I'm probably not going to be here. Something's going to happen later on. So when you see those conditions happening, or if you're looking at the RAWs, we have a couple of RAWs system, which are remote activated weather stations that you can look at the weather. When the relative humidity starts to plummet and the temperature goes up, especially 8 o'clock in the morning, it's time to do your due diligence, walk around your house and make sure you're prepared for wildfire if you haven't done it ahead of time. Topography, we can't change that. We've got canyons and slopes all over Cambria. If you walk out on your back deck and it's 150 feet to the ground below you, all that slope underneath you is fuel that could gobble up your house. You need to do as best you can to get rid of that. And fire starts. I mean, you know, that's the real issue. How does a fire start? Somebody asked me earlier, how does it start? And I said, how many ways do you want me to go over? There's about 50 or 60 ways a fire could start. The one that we're most concerned about is that arsonist that goes out there that takes advantage of the weather and has just a twisted mindset where they like to see what fire can do. Typically, Cambria doesn't enter its really peak fire season till kind of the beginning of August and can go all the way to the end of December if we don't get enough rain. So I hate to make y'all feel bad, but I'm going to be honest with you. Many people, even neighbors in my neighborhood, go, well, we got fog last night if we were in the middle of wildfire season. We got fog last night, so we're not going to have a fire in the next couple of days. As soon as the sun comes out, warms up, if there's no cloud cover, that fog mist on that vegetation is gone in a short period of time. It never penetrates the interior of the plant, and any fire that gets started will burn right through it, and it's off at the races. So don't be fooled that fog coming in is going to protect you. It's not. So a lot of people think home hardening is like the old soldier with that big shield that you need to harden your home for that big, huge flame front that's coming out of that winged dragon or whatever it is that's next door. And although some of you may live in areas where there is a lot of fuel next to your house and you may be approached by a big, huge flame front that's coming up on you, really that's not the issue. Home hardening has to do with taking care of those areas around your home, on your home, and next to it that can catch or trap an ember, start a small fire that becomes a big fire. And I know there's probably not a firefighter in this room, myself included, that hasn't seen hundreds of those situations occur in our career where they either damaged a home, we put it out before it got in the home, or it gutted or destroyed the home. So it's the embers is the primary cause of what home hardening is all about. So again, it's these wind-carried airborne embers, as you can see here in the picture. They go all over the place. When I first started here as fire chief in 2000, we had a retired CAL FIRE dozer operator that came up to the fire station, and he said, the guy brought me this, and I thought you might want to have it. And there was a fire called the Werferling Fire, which was about 65 or 70 miles north of Lake Nacimiento. An oak leaf fell out of the sky, trailing smoke, and landed in this guy's backyard, and he went out and stomped it out, and he picked up the leaf and took it to this guy, and he brought it to me, and I framed it, and it was up in the fire station. And that's just to show you how far away that is. It was a burning ember from a leaf that landed here in Cambria. So that, and that was one. Imagine if there's thousands of them. So let's start with the basics. I know you've all heard a lot about defensible space, but there's a myth about defensible space, and I hope to put that to rest today, and I hope you will realize that defensible space may not be what you think it is. So it's that area around your home that needs to be cleared so your home can stand alone. It is not the area around your home that you may clear so that the 2,000 fire engines that are coming into Cambria to park one at every house can go in your house and defend your house. That's not going to happen. Look where we live. Who's coming to help us from up north? Maybe one U.S. Forest Service engine. That's it. And then we have CAL FIRE and Cambria Fire here, fortunately. And then everybody else has to come from the east and the south. And then it takes a while to get other counties mobilized to come here. And I hear people all the time, well, in Santa Maria, we have an air attack base from the Forest Service, and we have one in Paso Robles. And those air tankers will be here lickety-split. they're gone all the time. They get a fire in Fresno, they're gone. San Bernardino, they're gone. Chico, they're gone. They try to fill in, but they're gone a lot, so you can't depend on them to come in and put out the fire. So it's that area around your home that you want to clear of vegetation. And some other things that you probably don't think of as fuel to ignite your home, but it is. So you want to reduce and eliminate those fuels around your house. Now, I know that our friend from UP Homeowners talked about 5 feet. I like to use the 6 foot moniker because, as you see later on in my presentation, if you're going to replace the deck boards outside your sliding glass window and things like that, you're going to want 6 feet because you don't want to cut a 2 foot wide board. You know, you want to do two of them and then cut one in half. So just go with 6 feet because that's typically the size of lumber. So you want to try to go 6 feet out. You want to give yourself more space if you have to for hardscape. 6 to 30 feet out is limited fuels, and 30 feet plus, ha, 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 what a joke. Why? Nobody's property in Cambria is big enough to do that. So why the two little up arrows? You and your neighbors behind you, next to you, behind you, over the next block, across the street, you all need to work together because their defensible space is your defensible space. You can't just go to your property line and say, I'm good, especially if on the other side there's a thatch 8 feet high. Call the fire department. Chief Berkey's here. He or the crew will handle it. Remove those plants or ground cover that really don't belong there that are combustible. If you're not sure if they are or not, either look up online or ask the experts. A lot of people here in town love to get those chips from the tree folks. Okay, you got embers falling out of the sky, and they're falling on wood chips on the ground that are going to become more embers, and your home or your backyard's going to catch on fire. Don't use that stuff. When the bank over here first opened, it's Mechanics Bank now, but when they first opened, on their landscape design, they put in gorilla hair. I said, you're not going to want to do that. Gorilla hair is that really fine, lashy stuff you can buy in bags at the hardware store. You're not going to want to do that. The last time I checked with them was about a year ago. They've had 60 fires. They're all small, but 60 fires in there because the gorilla hair gets going and it just starts creeping on out. So they're eventually going to replace that. So get rid of all that combustible stuff. And I see some of the hardware stores selling recycled rubber in bags that you can put out, you know, outside. Rocks, pebbles, you know, sand, dirt, whatever you want. You want something non-combustible around your home. You don't want something to land, start that on fire, and let the wind blow it up and become another ember. And now you've got another burning projectile coming at your house. Limb those trees up. If they're younger, you want to go up, you know, anywhere from, you know, 1 to 2, 3 feet, you know, as they get taller, you can go up further. You don't want a ground fire to get in the lower limbs of a tree or a bush and then go up to the top. And then when it's up there, especially if the wind's blowing, it blows the flames horizontal and now it's up against your house. And now you do have the dragon, you know, blowing flames right against your house, and you don't want to do that. We're going to talk about gates and other things and floor mats here in just a minute. But defensible space is really important. So what do our homes and our businesses have in common with the wind and a sailboat? Well, a lot. Like a sail, we have lots of spaces around, in, and on our home that can catch embers. They can be lodged outside or even enter the home and catch the home on fire from the inside out. So we're talking about gaps, cracks, and opening. You can see here there's some damage here on this window right here, and that, whoop. And that's going to cause an ember to get lodged in there. You can see these gaps at the end of the roof. If you have a tile roof, the tile should be sealed at the end. If you can see under the tile, you don't have a Class A fire-resistive roof. You have a Class A roof covering, but it's not going to stop the embers from going under the tile. I've been on lots of wildfires where a tile roof home was on fire, and the embers got underneath the tile because those little blocks that are supposed to be underneath are not there anymore. They've fallen out. Any of these cracks that you can see on the side, those are all places they're going. Yeah, there's a place here for you to lodge embers, and some of them will go out, hopefully, but a lot of them will burn for a long, long time, and when there's smoke in the neighborhood, you don't know your outside of your house is on fire, so take the time now to seal them and make sure that that issue is taken care of. Exterior building vents, 1/8-inch mesh. Several years ago, it was 1/4-inch. There's been a lot of national resource studies and everything by the NFPA and a bunch of other organizations to determine, and now they've determined that 1/8-inch steel mesh, metal mesh, is required basically to keep the embers out. That doesn't mean you take the vents off the top of your house and just put in a 1/8-inch mesh. It means you put this on in addition. A lot of our homes in Cambria, you will see these louver vents, this thing here and this one over here, where you see those just little louvers. And if you go up in your attic or have your handyman go look, you'll look up in there, and behind it, there's probably nothing if it's an older home. So you want to put in my house, I have two of these vents, and behind there I have eighth inch mesh, and then about an inch behind it I have another, so I have double eighth inch mesh. Has it affected the ventilation in my attic? Not really, not at all. So I'm still getting great ventilation, and that's all working very well. The other thing is don't forget about the area underneath your home right here. You have vents there too for the subfloor of your house to get wind going through. Those need eighth inch vents as well. I do want to point these out. These pipes you see sticking up in the roof, those are vents for your sinks and your toilet and your and everything to allow things to drain properly in the house. And you need proper ventilation for those to go. If you go by my house, none of mine are open to the top like that. All of mine have a bonnet on the top with a spark arrestor around it to keep them in. I did some research to make sure, because you don't want to block those, because otherwise you're going to have a terrible stench and things aren't going to drain properly. But those embers, if they go down that metal or plastic pipe, guess where they go? They go to that plastic elbow underneath the sink in your bathroom or wherever it is. It's plastic. It's going to catch fire. And now the fire is burning inside your house, unbeknownst to you. So those are the things you want to cover, even your dryer vents and things like that. You want to make sure that that's all, you know, taken care of. Your window skylights and doors, they may have gaps around them. Seal them, especially garage doors. I go by neighborhoods all the time and I see garage doors where there's a gap on each side. The wind pushing those embers, it'll go right inside, and guess what? Now the fire's burning inside your garage. The other thing is that during wildfire season, if you're going to leave your home, close all of your windows. I know you like ventilation to go through, but any window you leave open is going to be a natural habitat for if an ember can get through and get inside, it's going to end up in on the floor, next to the curtain, on the mat in your bathroom, and it's going to catch the house on fire. And obviously one of the big ticket items here is to have a double pane windows. And I know a lot of the folks in our county love to sell you vinyl windows and things like that. Vinyl windows will warp in a fire and they'll fall completely out of the house. There's only maybe five or six screws holding them in. The glass will snap, it'll fall out, and you'll have a huge hole. So you want something that's metal clad. You can have aluminum with vinyl covering over the top of them, but make sure you either get fire rated windows if you're going to replace them, even if you do them one at a time. But I would recommend that you stay away from just solid vinyl windows or anything like that that can warp from radiant heat from a fire. What about those window screens? I bet you most of you, because you have a rust problem, you probably got rid of your window screens and you've gone to vinyl. You know, what happens if you get a hot piece of material next to pantyhose? It melts and you got a hole in it. That's what you got outside your windows if you have vinyl screens, is you have pantyhose out there. So if an ember hits it, it's going to burn right through. And even if the window's closed, there's probably this much of a gap between the window and the screen. And so the fire's going to start out there on the ledge, not outside your house, but it could eventually burn in. So one at a time, or whatever you have to do, replace those screens with some sort of a metal screen. And again, the screens should also be aluminum or metal clad, not a vinyl outer casing that the screens are attached to, so that they don't warp, melt, and now the only thing that's exposed is the whole window. There's no screen anymore. This picture over here, you can see in here, this is where a fire got in through a vent and started to run through the ceiling. And the fire crew happened to see smoke coming out of the house and went in and made a great stop. Otherwise, that house would have been on the ground. All the stuff you have outside of your house that's combustible. Combustible means it's ordinary combustible. What's ordinary combustible? A candle wick, paper, wood. That's ordinary combustible. You'll hear some people that don't know what they're talk about wildfires, and they say it's flammable. Flammable's gasoline, and there are some natural vegetation that are flammable, but not all of them are. Most of them are combustible. You want to remove all those combustible things away from your house, at least 6 feet away and further if you can. We're talking about wood piles. We're talking about those beautiful planters outside. Get planters that are terracotta if you got to have them underneath the window. Put soil in them and put plants that are not going to be conducive to catch fire. If you have plastic planters on your back deck, take them off the deck or replant whatever you have in them and put them in terracotta. I used to see this a lot. I hope it doesn't happen anymore. I'm sure the chief's going to take care of that. People store all their firewood underneath their deck. That's kind of like putting 25 cans of gasoline underneath there and putting a wick on out there so it can catch fire. So I know when I did a lot of house inspections when I was chief, I go, do you want your house to burn down? You know, I mean, really? Because, I mean, with that underneath there, you've got no chance. Well, what do I do? Well, enclose it. Do something so that well, then it's harder to get out. Well, then you're going to lose your home. And if you're in it, you may not get out. Combustible fences, decks, deck boards, planters, furniture, all that too close to your home, that's an ingredient for fire. So in this picture in here, you see a gate with a part of the fence, and you see the trash container that we all have. Those are way too close to the house. So what are you saying, Bob? You saying that I take the gate and the fence out? No, I'm saying you replace these combustible deck boards with something that's non-combustible, like Hardy makes siding. There's a bunch of other places that make Class A non-combustible things you can use for fencing. Do that, especially if you don't want a metal gate where people can see through. But you need to move that combustible stuff away, because that's a fuse to bring the fire, if a gate catches on fire, up into your home. Then it goes up into the eaves, and you're off and running at the races. Here in this picture, you see these planters out here. They're plastic. An ember gets in there, the plastic gets going, melts down on the deck. You've seen plastic burn before. It's going to create a fire. Then the deck's burning, and away you go. And the area here in front of these sliding glass doors, or any door you have on a deck, you want non-combustible boards. If you can't replace your whole deck, you want non-combustible boards at least 6 feet out the length of the sliding glass door or longer, so that any embers that go out there will go out. They won't be able to catch fire, get that deck going, and then burn. Because when the fire gets hot enough and the flames get larger enough, it starts to scramble the material the glass is made of. And those components that glass is made of start to spin and move. That's not really a scientific thing, but you get the idea. And eventually they will craze and they'll fall out. So then the outer pane of your double pane window's gone. And when the second one goes, then the glass is gone and it's inside your house. So that's why it's important to keep that 6 foot non-combustible all the way around the house. Gutter guards. I know there's a lot of people out there really pounding on gutter guards and saying, get them. A lot of them have not been wildfire tested. So be very, very careful, as Bugs Bunny used to say. And all the ones that I have, I bought from one of the big box stores, and they're metal. But you can't put gutter guards up and go, I'm done. You got to clean them off every year. You got to scrape what catches on the top of them out of there and clean them off. And every once in a while, you need to take them off and flush your gutters. The other thing is I know a lot of you probably have plastic gutters. Well, you know what I'm going to say about plastic gutters? If the fire does get going in there, now that plastic's drooling on down, it looks like liquid napalm, and it's going to ignite your house on fire. Because behind that, there's a small little fascia board that is right below where your roofing is, and it doesn't take much for that to get ignited. So metal gutters, metal gutter guards are a very important component of home hardening. Doormats, outside trellises, furniture, all of this stuff, gazebos, they're all, move them away. If they're connected to your house, move them as far away as possible. Or maybe even decide, you know, maybe I don't need those anymore, or get something with a metal roof. Again, embers are looking for a place to start. This lower picture here, you can see it's a fire in the gutter. There's no gutter guards in this one. You can see what's happening. And it's already, you can't see in the picture very well unless I blow it up, which I'm not going to do, but it's already burnt into the fascia. So it's already starting to enter the attic of this person's home. Home hardening works. It's proven, especially if you work with your neighbors. The 0 to 6 foot area around your home is vitally important for your home survival. Because to expect the fire department to park a fire engine at every 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 houses and defend it is not that likely. Especially in a scenario which could easily happen here, which you may see later, where one home catches on fire, then another, and now it's multiple homes that are actually causing the fire threat to the rest of the community. So be prepared. Keep your fuel tank 3/4 full. Most of you probably know there's only one gas station in town that can pump fuel if the power's out, so know which one that is. Back in and drive out. Why? Because in an emergency, it's much easier to get out of your neighborhood if you can drive out. No two ways out. Have a go bag. All this stuff that you've probably done and known about before here. This picture on the bottom, I want to make sure we're clear. I'm not advocating you spray your house down with water to protect it from wildfire. It's a huge waste of water and it doesn't work. It's not fruitful at all. It's a waste of time. What I'm showing here is if you can spray the outside of your house anywhere with water, and that water can get in into the attic or in somewhere in your house, then you need to seal that, because that's a place for embers to get in. That's a pathway, a tunnel for embers to get in. Again, be prepared. I have 3/4 inch, they're heavy, garden hoses all the way around my house with a nozzle on them to, you know, if there is a spot fire and I'm home. Large address number so the fire department can see you. If they can't see you, they can't help you. So I know a lot of you get these big fancy bronze signs that say your address on them, and 6 months after you get them, it's a bronze, dark brown background, and now it's faded because of the ocean air, and now the numbers are dark brown, and they're going to drive right by it. They can't see it. So it's got to be durable contrast, bright numbers on a dark background, dark numbers on a light background. And, you know, make sure you're prepared with reverse 911. You don't want to be fighting with kitty or doggy, or if you happen to have a pet anaconda at home or whatever. You won't want to try to take them out in a wildfire because they know the poop's going to hit the fan long before you do, and they're going to go crazy. So you need a crate or something rigid to take them out with, or you're going to get hurt. And unfortunately, I've seen that firsthand. One of my good friends here, retired Fire Chief Keith Agson, is going to talk about Genesis Protect, which is our evacuation software. And all of you should have that on your phone right now. And if you don't leave here today without loading it. That'll give you notice about any pending evacuations, fires or emergencies in the county. You'll know which zone you're in, everything else. I don't want to take his thunder away because he's a big guy. He'll beat me up later. So anyway, I'll leave that to him. So if you need more information, Cal Fire's here in our community. We've got Cambria Fire. I'm here. I can be reached at any time. I do free neighborhood group, or if you have a chi group you want to get together and look at your neighborhood and provide some information about your specific neighborhood and how you can basically home harden or work together to make it better, I'm happy to help. So with that, I will stop and answer any questions.
I have a question for you. We've talked about this, the gas line.
Yes. Yeah, there's a number of different ways on the internet that you can find how to shut off your gas line. You can ask the fire department, you can ask other people. It is not recommended unless your home is on fire and it's safe for you to do it, for you just arbitrarily shut off your gas. Because if you're going to re-turn it on again, you're going to have to wait for SoCal Gas to come and turn it on, and that could be a long time. So I wouldn't just shut it off to shut it off because there's a fire way over the hill, but you should know how to shut it off in an emergency. And it you can do it with a crescent wrench. There's other things. If you want to know how to do that, you can again reach out to Cambria Fire, Cal Fire, myself, or somebody else, and we can help you with that. Any other questions? I'll be hanging around afterwards, and I'll be in the other room if you want to ask me any questions. So thank you for your time. Remember, it's the little things that make you safe and make our community safe. Thank you.
Okay, I find Keith.
There you go.
Come on back, Zoom. I can't share, I can't get Zoom up.
Can you share your screen? You're screen sharing right there already, aren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
All right. All right, we'll move along. If you don't know, if there is a fire, right? If there's a fire nearby or if there's a fire in town, you want to know if you're supposed to evacuate, how you're supposed to evacuate. So Keith Agson, former battalion fire chief with Cal Fire, and now with the Office of Emergency Services with Slo County, will now give you some information on how to know when to evacuate. Okay, Keith?
All right. Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you, David, so much. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Keith Agson. At 35 years in the fire service, I kind of just was a suitcase firefighter. I worked in Atascadero for about 27 years, Templeton for a short period of time as their interim chief, Paso as a battalion chief, and then I retired as a fire chief after 6 years in San Luis. About a year ago, I was given the opportunity to assist County OES through Fire Safe Council with the Genesis Protect in the Zone Haven program. And so we've been working on that pretty adamantly for the last year. We actually launched it in August of of 2023. And today we're just gonna give you an overview of that program, what we've done with it, and how it affects not only the public, but also our first responders. And I'm gonna have to keep putting my cheaters on because I forgot my glasses when I left this morning, so. So we were fortunate to work with Fire Safe Council to be able to initiate a grant request through California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection as part of the California Crisis or Climate Investment Program. And so it was about $187,000 that was provided to us as part of this grant. And how we really arrived at it is, as a county, the county fire chiefs recognized that each jurisdiction, as well as county fire and CAL FIRE, San Luis Obispo, had a different way of doing evacuations and notifications. And we really decided that, hey, we need to have one streamlined way that on how we're gonna conduct evacuations at all levels throughout the county, for each jurisdiction, and then for our public, regardless of what your location, you would be able to get that notification and you would be able to understand and know what to do and where to go in the event of an evacuation. And so when we started to look and see what programs were available, there was a program up in the San Mateo County called Zone Haven, which they had exercised with several of their large fires that looked appealing to us. We did some research and we actually decided that would be the program we'd go with. So we wrote the grant. We were successful in getting the grant. It's been managed through Fire Safe Council. It's been pushed over to San Luis County OES, and we've been working through all the different sections of that. So one of the very first things that we did is we identified our different stakeholders, and really it's law enforcement, because law enforcement is who does evacuations. During an emergency, the incident commander or unified commanders at that emergency oftentimes will identify that they need to either shelter in place, provide evacuation warning, or an evacuation order, and who's gonna actually do that? Because we're also attending to the emergency. So firefighters and law enforcement are attending to whatever the emergency may be. If it's a fire, for example, they don't necessarily have the time to go through the neighborhoods and do evacuations. And so that really falls on our law enforcement partners. And so we've really gathered all of this, we've gathered and put this program together so it goes from top to bottom. And we first started by saying, hey, we have to identify, how are we gonna identify the zones and what are the zones are gonna look like? So we'll talk a little bit about that. Some of our objectives, obviously, number one is it's to improve public safety. So again, it's that consistency across the board. The program is for large-scale evacuations, and it's really important to understand that we wouldn't necessarily be activating the zones if this was a small-scale incident. So if there was a structure fire in your jurisdiction, wouldn't necessarily cause the Zone Haven program or a zone program to be activated. If there was a shelter in place because they had a barricaded subject and law enforcement was at scene, that would not be part of this program. But it really is for those larger scale where we know we've got a fire that's moving into an area, we need to warn people and or we need to evacuate people. It's also to evacuate the areas that are necessary. So not just doing blanket evacuations. Oftentimes we'll say we want to evacuate an area north of here, south of here, east of there, west of there. That's very difficult because right now if we asked everybody in the room, hey, which way's north, which way's south? Many of you are going to be correct. I probably are going to be a little bit off, but it's during an emergency, you may not understand or know, hey, does that affect me or does that not affect me? So going to the zones makes it a little bit easier, especially if you know your zone. And then providing the community with the clear and timely information, that is also really, really important. It's not just notifying you that you need to evacuate and where to evacuate to and what the evacuation routes are, but updated information. Where are the resource centers? Where are the shelters gonna be located at? Updated information if you can return, if we're gonna repopulate an area. So all of these were some of the objectives that we had set forth to make sure that we flushed all of these things out in developing our program. So what is a zone program? So it's a standardized and pre-designated evacuation zones. And I'm going to show you a slide here in a moment with Cambria's zones. It's able to coordinate fire, law, EMS, our EOCs, our Emergency Operations Centers, the media and the public, and to get everybody on the same page. It's a standardized map for evacuation area. So regardless of where we're at, if San Luis Obispo or Cambria, if Cambria was to go to Arroyo Grande to assist their community during a large-scale emergency, the way that their maps are set up are exactly the same as Cambria. So it's across the board. Having a public notification alert warning system that everybody's has access to. And then the intent of use of the program, just again, it's for large scale evacuations. So those major emergencies. So it could be a wildfire, it could be a hazardous material incident where we need to move people out of an area to deem them safe. It is meant for all hazard emergencies, and it's a protective action notification system. It helps make all of our responders and the public and the media are all on the same page again, and then it adds to the alert warning system. So we'll talk about the different ways that we notify the public, but it's just one more measure for how we're going to be able to communicate with the public during an emergency. So you can see on the map here, this is an example of Cambria. And as you note, when you look at the area, it has the Cambria, and then it has SLC. SLC is going to be San Luis County. So the county fire department is CAL FIRE. They protect all of the surrounding areas throughout the entire county. We have 571 zones. So when you start to go through and look at Paso Robles and Arroyo Grande and Atascadero, everybody's went in and they've identified their zones. And so you can see what your zone is. If you want more information on your zone, we're going to show you our website where you can go to and you can type in your address and it will pull your zone information up. And how many of you have seen the billboard just down the road here that says, know your zone, ready, slow? All right, great. Great. Hopefully that was a good investment. We've got a couple of those countywide, and we're doing a lot of advertising right now. So on this slide, this is our website, readyslow.org. And I highly recommend everybody visit readyslow.org. There's a lot of incredibly valuable information, even outside of the evacuation program that's available here. As Chief Putney was mentioning, the preparedness side, how important that is, all of that information is on there. The Ready, Set, Go program, all of your preparedness for developing an emergency plan for your household, your 72-hour kit, all that information is on there. So if you go to this program, and if you click on the prepare, then the bottom left-hand side, it says search. You can actually type in your address, and then at the bottom below there's going to be a map. And within that map, it's going to pop up, and it'll show what zone you're at. In addition, on the right-hand side, you can see it shows what the status is of that zone. So during an emergency, we can change those zones. We can advise if there's a shelter in place, if there's an evacuation warning, or there's going to be an evacuation order that's been made. And so it's a really great program. As Chief Putney had also mentioned, so it's a little confusing. Zone Haven, in the midst of us working on this project, sold their software to another software company called Genesis. So Genesis has that program, and now we think they may even be transitioning to another software program. But with that said, there is an app. It's the Genesis app that you can download on your phone. If you download that on your phone, you download that on your phone, you make it active. It's an opt-in system. Regardless of where you're at in our county, if there's an evacuation nearby that's going to affect you, it will activate your phone. It's just like the alert warning system that comes naturally in your phone. That's an automatic opt-out system. It's very, very similar. So roles and responsibilities of this program. So it's for public safety protective actions, and it's really for the agency having that that emergency. So we'll say that we have a wildfire and it's on the western part of the city of Atascadero, and it's burning into the county. They're going to be in unified command because they'll be working with San Luis County or CAL FIRE Fire Department. And the incident commanders that are at scene will make the determination, hey, in advance of this fire, do we need to put a warning out for anybody in that area from the edge of town moving towards Morro Bay off Highway 41? Do we want to provide a warning? So they'll look at those zones. They have the ability to pull those zones up on their phone, as well as having printed map books. And they can make that determination and go, hey, we're going to do an evacuation order of these zones, and we're going to do an evacuation warning of these other zones. They'll bring their law enforcement partners in, and in that situation, it would be the city of Tascadero's law enforcement, it would be the sheriff's department, and it would actually be CHP, because it's probably going to affect Highway 41. And they would provide them that information. At that time, what we would call our evacuation group supervisor, they're going to pick the phone up and they're going to contact our duty officer. County OES has a 24/7 duty officer that has a cell phone and a laptop with them all the time. They pass that phone off weekly, and the duty officer would pick the phone up. They would gather the information. They determine what zones need to be evacuated at what level, and then they would go into that program and they would make that status update. They'd make those changes. They also would hit the alert warning, and that alert warning is going to be our reverse 911, alert slow, and a variety of other social media and television and radio sources. And that is to be done within a 10-minute period. Now, previous to that, we could have delays of up to an hour trying to get that information out. And so we've really tried to expedite it and to have a sole source, one person that's making that call that's able to activate. Our fallback is the Emergency Command Center for Cal Fire and the Sheriff's Dispatch also have the same exact capabilities of pushing this information out and changing those zones during an emergency. So the last part there, I want to highlight too, is that as soon as the information goes out, then it's the OES. OES is going to be they're going to activate either their DOC or their EOC, and they'll send an individual to the incident to start working with that agency having jurisdiction with their public information to make sure we're sending out accurate information. Part of the information you would receive if a zone is being evacuated would also be what the evacuation routes are and the locations that we want you to go. Is it a temporary or refuge area? Is it a shelter area? And one of the questions we get oftentimes is, well, I want to know what my evacuation routes are right now today. And it's hard to do to provide that to you. And frankly, it's unsafe to do because we don't want you to always fall back to go a certain way because that may be the direction of where the emergency is. And we don't want you to have to drive through the emergency or to the emergency. And so that's one of the questions. Now, when you do your planning as a family or as a household, what we really encourage you to do is to identify multiple ways to evacuate. And I understand in Cambria, when you get to the main road, you're either going to go north or you're going to go south. But at least having several ways to get to that main road is going to be important that you've pre-planned that out. So for public outreach and notification, we talked about the agency having jurisdiction, their incident commander or assignee, and that's typically going to be your law enforcement officer, is going to contact that duty officer, and they're going to provide that information, what zones are going to be evacuated, what level of evacuation, the route, the evacuation routes, and the location we'd like people to go so that we can collect them. At that point, the duty officer is going to issue that information. They're going to activate. On the right hand side there, that slide. They're going to activate that zone, and there will be information that will be continuing to be updated on that web page. Now we understand the power could go out. You could lose power, and you may not have access to it within your computer at your home. But you're probably going to have your phone. And every cell site in the county of San Luis Obispo has some level of backup. Some of them are a lot better than others, but they all have some redundancy and depth of backup. It could be for an hour. It could be for a week, for that much. We learned that during the continuity of operation plans. We were developing those during the pandemic as like, what would we do if this happened? What would we do? And when we started to reach out to the different carriers, we realized all of them have some level of backup. Now understand, you have a lot of people getting on that system. It may be slow, but you'll still have the ability to get on and see, hopefully be able to get on and see what your zone status is. We talked about alerts in conjunction, and I'm going to actually jump ahead here, as to how we notify the public. And so how we notify the public is very important. And so the first thing I would ask you is if you haven't done it, please, please, go to the sheriff's website and enlist in reverse 911. That is our primary way to be able to reach out and contact folks in our community. And that is an opt-in system. If you have a landline, you're automatically in that system. But if you use your cell phone as your main phone, or you have it on you most of the time, you need to go into that website and register your phone and give them the authority to give that information. As we provide the initial information to evacuate, what the route is and the locations that we want you to evacuate to, we're also able to push out updates through Reverse 911. So it's very, very helpful. The Genesis Protect, that app, conversely, it's going to get the same information. And we will be putting the same information out on all three of our social media websites and encouraging the agency with the emergency to be doing the same, as well as radio and television. So we have in here, and I should have changed it to Genesis, but it says Zone Haven, so that's that app. There's the wireless emergency alerts, and that comes in your phone. That's an opt-out system. So you guys recall about 4 or 5 months ago, FEMA did a test and your phone should have alarmed. That's part of that WIA, and we have access to that. There's a few steps in order for us to utilize that WIA. Reverse 911 is obviously going to be the best case scenario for us. Social media, we're on Twitter or X, Facebook, and then Instagram. If you're in the protective active zones, which you're not here in Cambria, but if you're down in the in those areas for Diablo Canyon, the sirens can be utilized. To my knowledge, they've never been utilized for anything other than just testing at this point over the last 30 or so years. There's the EAS system or the emergency broadcast system, and then route alerting is just ongoing updated information. And then one of the programs that we've invested in that we're going to be pushing out by the first of the year is Alert Slow. And it's very similar to the Genesis program. It's an app. The nice thing about it is it has not only just the ability to push information out to your phone, but it also takes you right to our website. So you can immediately pull open and type in your zone and be able to look at the status of your zone. So those are just a variety of ways that we would utilize in order to contact the public and provide information during an evacuation. So I mentioned Reverse 911. This is just a screenshot I took of their page. And so again, that's to provide information to the public during a disaster. We see you sneaking away. It will call your phone. If you have a landline, it's automatically going to be set up to continue to call your phone. And then for your cell phone, it's that opt-in system. So it works really, really well. It's been utilized quite a bit in our county for a variety of different emergencies. So if you haven't opted in, we really encourage you to do so. Just real quick, as I mentioned it a couple times, and I want to make sure we understand, shelter in place versus evacuation warning and evacuation order. A shelter in place typically is when we don't want to move people because it may be more dangerous to move the household than to keep them in the location they're at. Could be because it's a hazardous material, maybe it's an active shooter, et cetera. And so a shelter in place is really for you to get in your home, shut everything up, shut your HVAC system down, turn your lights on, and to be able to hunker down, listen to your radio, watch your television, follow your social media, wait for reverse 911 information and updates to advise you when the shelter in place has been lifted. Oftentimes, it's utilized most oftenly for law enforcement, where we see it used when they've got a barricaded subject or something of that nature. An evacuation warning is that we recognize there's going to be a threat to the area that you're at, and to be prepared. And so, a part of what Chief Putney had talked about is having that plan in place and having your vehicle set, activating your plan, being ready to evacuate if needed. So getting all your 72-hour kit and all those things in your vehicle and ready to go. However, if you have somebody in your household that has maybe some access functional needs or medical issues that may delay them or take them a little bit longer to evacuate, you may consider actually starting at that point in time. And then the last part of those evacuation warnings is Think about what you're going to do with your pets. You know, is your animals able to ride in the vehicle outside of a cage, or do you need to have them in some type of box to be able, some type of carrier to safely move them? Have them in the house ready to go, so you can put them in your vehicle pretty rapidly, and you can roll out. An evacuation order is when we've deemed that it's imminent, that you need to leave the area. It's urgent you leave the area. You've been given the route information and where to go to, and we need you to evacuate. Now, the question we get often at times is, can we make people evacuate? We cannot. We cannot. Your house is your kingdom. If you choose to stay, you can stay. If you leave the area under an order, we can keep you. Law enforcement can keep you from coming back into the area if the emergency is still at hand. However, we can't make you. We can't make you leave. And so I've heard that several times. Well, you've got to be able to just make these people and arrest them and this and that. No, we're not able to do that. But we really recommend that if the professionals have told you that you should leave, that you should have a plan, and you should roll. If yourself or somebody in your household does have some access, functional, or medical needs and a disability where they may not be able to evacuate on their own without assistance, you can go to readyslow.org, and you can type in the assistance registration, and this form will come up. You can fill this form up for a household member or yourself, and regardless of where you're at in the county. And so we collect this information, and then we provide it with those agencies having jurisdiction so they're aware. So that if they have an emergency, and we'll use in San Luis Obispo, they had a wildfire last year and they evacuated a couple of zones. The individuals that were on this list also were contacted by PD. So it wasn't that big of an incident they had, but they were able to go in contact and make sure that those people were taken care of, whether they were evacuated or somebody was assisting them to evacuate or they needed assistance to get evacuation. So it's a great program. Once you've opted into this program, our office will call you each January just to check in with you to make sure you still want to be part of the program, make sure your address hasn't changed or you haven't moved. Evacuation preparedness, we just talked, Chief Putney hit it right on the nose. All the things when it comes to hardening your home, knowing your zones, it's only as good as how prepared you are and what you've done to be able to stand on your own. What we found in the fire service in California is oftentimes you're about 72 hours on your own during a major disaster. And a great point was, and we can't necessarily have a fire engine in everybody's home. Even in the city of San Luis Obispo, where I formerly was the fire chief, we only have 4 fire stations for 47,000 people. And so our ability to get to everybody's emergency, there's going to be a delay. And so for the ability for you to stand on your own and assist your household as well as your neighbors is incredibly important. So if you go to readyslow.org under prepare, there's family preparedness. There's disaster planning, emergency supply kits, stuff for your children, stuff for your animals. To help you, it's just really good checklist of, have you thought this out? Do you have I do. I had a second pair of reading glasses in my bag when I forgot my glasses. Do you have a pair of reading glasses? Do you have a copy of your prescriptions? Do you have a place to go? Do you have a communication plan if in the event a household member or a family member is not at home during that evacuation and they know where to go and how to communicate with you? A lot of really great information is on the website. So I'd highly encourage you to take the opportunity to go through that. And make sure you've signed up for those emergency alerts. The big thing is knowing your zone. Know what zone that you reside in. I cannot stress that enough. Build that 72-hour kit. You know, that includes food and water. If you don't know basic first aid, there's a lot of opportunities to get first aid through American Red Cross, our different hospitals. And then again, another really important thing is plan for your have a plan for your animals. That's the one thing that people will be really delayed is trying. You know, your animals, if they're outside, they're going to be upset. They're going to be scared from the smoke and everything that's going on. Is the ability to have a plan. What are you going to do with your animals? And if you have large animals, hoofed animals, horses, cattle, and things of that nature. Well, especially for horses, we have a great evacuation team, HEAT, that's in our county that we work with, that Cal Fire and all the agencies work with, that just does a phenomenal job. And they get a pass. They get the ability to come in during an emergency and help evacuate those large animals when it's safe. So. And then I just really want to encourage you outside of going to readyslow.org, our Instagram is new. It's County of Slow OES. I'm told every time I give this presentation, please get people to follow us. I think we had 6 people a couple of months ago, and I think we're up to 16. So please follow us. We put out valuable information on that, on Instagram almost daily. There's a lot of good information from that. And then again, during an evacuation or during an emergency, we're going to push information out to our social media sites to keep people informed. So I'm doing a little catching up. I know that was quick. What questions can I answer for you? Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Because of our limited options, it would be helpful to have a few more instructions other than close your windows and turn on the lights.
Yeah.
What other advice could you provide?
Great question. What if you can't leave? What if you're not even aware? You weren't notified and you weren't leaving. We've taken all these steps to give you the information of what all the things that you should do, but what if you can't leave? And so it really starts right now today at this moment. When you go back to your residence, your household, what have you done to harden your household? Chief Putney gave you some really good information, and there's a ton of stuff online. What actions can you take so that your home stands alone and that you don't have to worry about embers? You don't have to worry about, you've got plenty of defensible space that your house is able to stand on its own. So that would be the first thing, is to do what you can to harden your home so that if you have to stay, that it's two tenants and there's no way for you to evacuate, at that moment right there is that you have the ability to, your house is going to be hardened and it's going to be able to withstand the fire. The second part is, understand, is even when your house catches on fire, it doesn't just burn down right away. And so if you had to, you may have to wait until the fire passes, the main wildfire passes, and hunker down in your home, even if your home catches on fire, and then evacuate your home at the very last moment when things have burned away. Now, that's the most critical situation. And certainly, you know, that's a time of emergency decision that you're going to have to make. But if you're not able to evacuate, it's what can you do in advance to prepare your household so that you can stand on your own, that you're not relying on the fire department. And a great point is, you know, I worked in Atascadero for a long time. It's an intermixed community. It's not an interface community. It's very similar to Cambria, but they're much larger lots. And so the weed abatement program there is very effective, because even when we'd have fires, they'd burn into abated areas and we're able to control the fire. Whereas here, you're very dependent on your neighbors and them doing their fuel management and doing the things to create that defensible space. So whatever you can do in your immediate home and with your neighbors, it would be helpful. The other part of that is that we recognize when we put an evacuation order out that some people are not going to leave, is to be able to give updated information as to what's going on with the incident. And so, again, really, you know, paying attention to those alert warning systems will be important as well. So I don't know if I answered all your question.
That's helpful. You also said that law enforcement was going to really control, regulate.
They would actually be, yeah, correct. So that's one of the things that we're doing. So on the backside that I haven't shared is that, so they've got job aids. We've been producing videos for them, and we're doing field training with them. And one of the things that we've discovered is there's no area in the county that can stand on their own. So very similar to a fire, if there was a fire to happen here in Cambria, it wouldn't just be Cambria and San Luis County Fire that would be fighting the fire. It would be every agency in this county would be sending resources to assist this community, as they would expect to get the same anywhere else in the community. And that's through our automatic aid and mutual aid system. And so The same, conversely, is also for law enforcement. And so if we're going to evacuate a zone, that it also compels them to have a minimum of 5 deputies, 5 officers, depending on where you're at, and then to continue to grow based on the evacuation needs. And then the last part that we haven't gotten out to the public that we're working towards is to go back to a high-low siren. If you guys have heard the European siren, that is using something that's very unique, also to alert people that there's an evacuation going on, so that we can capture more people in a shorter period of time.
Yeah. That's really important because our internet and our cell service is so intermittent in this area.
Yeah, it is really a challenge, you know, countywide. But for this area, you're absolutely correct. So the ability to get and follow your radio, your all your major radio channels are going to get the same information. And we have the ability, not necessarily to take them over, but to share that information with them where it's closed their radio station off. I can't think of the term of it. I know Scott Jobbert would know right off the bat, but there is the ability for us to push that information over through the radio as well. So, and I think I seen you, he was talking about having the wind-up radios. I've got one. They work great. They got a little solar panel, and they're really inexpensive. So recommend them.
Keith, I wanted to thank you for coming today personally as a friend I've known for 30 some odd years, and watched your whole career and all the things you've done for us, and just share with the group here that maybe we should be a little more informed more frequently on a follow-up to the study that some Cal Poly professors did and presented several years ago.
Yeah.
And they essentially told this room that it would take up to 4 hours for us to get to Highway 1 to evacuate. I mean, from down near Fiscalini or whatever. And some of the recommendations that they made were to evacuate actually to Fiscalini, some safer place.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what your thoughts are, if there's any update on that.
I don't know that much about that study itself, so I would leave that to the Cambria folks that may have more information on it. But I would definitely recommend being aware of where you can go, where the temporary refuge areas are, where the safety zones are within your own community. Because you're right, it could take a super long time to get everybody out. The insurance gentleman, he talked about the tunnel fire up in Oakland. And as you recall, I think it was, I want to say 26 or 36. I remember 6 being a number. Folks that perished trying to evacuate. And they perished in their vehicles on these mid-slope roads. And from that, astonishingly, Oakland didn't do a whole bunch from that. They haven't made a lot of change. They're just in about the same situation they are right now as they were back in 1991, 92 when that fire occurred. And so it's having that knowledge and going early. If you get that warning, that may be enough to not wait for the order. If you don't feel comfortable, to start moving towards Highway 1 to be able to move out. But you're correct. It's one of the biggest challenges. Atascadero is very similar. You get in the far northwest part of Atascadero, you've got long drives back to the main roads, and they're very tight roads as well. So not as overgrown with the trees that you have, but they're long drives back out.
There was a fire east of us near Harmony, and when we heard about that fire, we did not wait. We left. My wife and I left, and we got to the Coast Highway in the same amount of time as we do normally, and we just left and came back the next day.
Yeah. Good.
All right. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you,
sir. Really appreciate it.
We got one more question.
The high school was a Red Cross shelter. Is that still in effect?
So I can't confirm that. What American Red Cross does is each year they go throughout the entire county, and they leverage contracts with different churches in different areas. Every school in the county can be pushed into being a shelter. So that's a state law that requires it. So if it is for Cambria, I can't tell you for certain, because we rely on Red Cross to do all of the sheltering, pretty much in the tri-counties for us. But more than likely, that would be the location. But if there was a fire in this community, most likely they would be moving you out of this community. So to San Luis Obispo, Morro Bay, for example.
All right. Thank you again. All right, I got a few more here. The next one is really important because we're going to talk a little bit more about evacuation, but then we're going to do the simulation, okay? Those of you who haven't seen this, okay, this is really astonishing what they can do with this sim table over here and showing what a fire would do in Cambria. So I'm going to introduce Greg here for a minute. As soon as I can get my screen back.
It's 12. Did you want to do a raffle?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Need help getting it up? Oh, you just share your screen. Okay.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yep. And then you want to click on the window. And to full screen it, there's that full screen right there. There's two arrows right next to it.
Oh, that one.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, that's good. All right, just real quickly. I'm going to go ahead and do three raffles, okay? So get your tickets out. First one is a bottle of great, I don't know how to pronounce the name of this, guys. Kutsarula wine, right? Somebody knows how to pronounce it. Our one of our CSD directors, Michael Thomas, picks out the number. And it is 4130275. 4130275. Going once, going twice, pick another one. Four one three zero two seven two. All right, Karen Dean. All right. All right. For those of you who are pet lovers, we have a gift certificate from Maddie Mays. 4130322. All right. Yay. And here we have a gift certificate from Luigi's Pizza. Yeah, good stuff, right? 4130251. All right, very good. All right, now moving along, we'll do the rest of the raffle after the demonstration and everything, okay? So stick around for the demonstration and stick around for the remaining prizes on the raffle. So we have next Greg Alex is a retired deputy fire chief for San Luis Obispo County, 31 years career in Cal Fire, and he was the North Coast Battalion chief here in Cambria, all right? So he knows what Cambria is all about, and today he's going to talk about an AI evacuation simulator, LADRIS, how it works and how it's going to provide information, and he will lead right into the simulation on a fire here in Cambria.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I've got a unique history with Cambria. My father was the captain at the Cambria Fire Station in 1976. There's pictures of me in the Pine Dorado on the back of the fire engines. I never lived in Cambria, but I definitely have been around it. I became a firefighter and then was in the Monterey area and then eventually moved my way here to San Luis Obispo, where I got to serve as the North Coast Battalion Chief in about the 2010 through 2015 era. And got to see quite a bit of fires. I also was involved with Bridge Street. That was my very first project as a fuel reduction project, and what a mess I walked into on that. I think they knew I was the newest chief, and they were like, hey, why don't you see if you could do something on Bridge Street? And I did, and we made that happen through Alan Peters and a lot of people and about $1 million, and we were able to do one side of the street. And later that has turned into, I think, about a $4 million project, and it's now done both sides of the street, and it's moving out into the area to protect this home, this community in a much greater way. Since retirement, I came to the Fire Safe Council, and one of my jobs with the Cal Fire was I was an intelligence officer at the state level. I would go to these big fires, and all those maps and all the web pages and all that stuff you see, I was doing a lot of that. And I got the opportunity to learn a lot about this county and its data and how deficient we were and as we were moving forward. And so we were able to do a lot with Cal Poly interns and bring in a lot of data, which are being used in all these programs today. They're being used in the summaries, they're being used in the simulations, they're being used at the state level, county level to determine a lot of different aspects of where fuel reduction should go, where the priorities should be. And when we were able to use Cambria as a great example, right? Your forest was dying. It was down to 60%, I think. And we kept telling everybody it was a problem, and everybody just looked at us and said, yeah, well, you know, keep putting your grants in and maybe you'll get one day. So we continued to move forward and brought the attention through social media at the very beginning of this. Through a website that we had done, we did, and Chief Mark Miller, we did a PSA about the forest dying here in Cambridge, and that took off, and it went to the state level, and that's what started our funding and getting some more funding for this community and its fire safety. So with the Fire Safe Council, they've got me kind of doing the same thing. I'm doing the websites, I'm doing all the data behind it, and I just wanted to bring your attention to the Fire Safe Council SLO website. We've noticed that OES and all these agencies are coming out with apps and things that you're supposed to sign up on, but you don't know where to go. And so FireSafeCouncilSLO.org has organized all that into one spot. So you can go to that website and you can find the things that are there. I think I'm not sure how I move forward. That was good. Okay. So just staying informed and listening for the updates. We talked about the Zone Haven and that they're going to update the incidents as they're happening on the Genesis Protect zone area. And that's available on ReadySLO.org. The County of San Luis Obispo Fire Department and many of the other departments are using Pulse Point. That's also an app that's on your phone, and it tells you live data of what's going on in your dispatch in your communities. Most of the communities in the county are on it, but Cambria is definitely there. So when you hear the site, I live in Pismo, and when I see the engine go by, I get on my little app, and I'm wondering just to see where they're going. So you can see medical aid information, all the calls that they're going to, and some basic information, who's responding, how long they've been there. And so that can give you an alert almost from the 911 caller. And a lot of times the alert's coming out before the dispatch even comes out. So you're pretty attuned to what's going on as far as the emergency response of your community people. The county sheriffs host the reverse 911. So we've talked about that. Super important to register. If you haven't registered for reverse 911, please do so. The process that you just heard about. So the incident commander decides we need to evacuate the area, and then that alert goes out however they decide to send that out. But the reverse 911 is a great way to do it. The local TV, radio, and media obviously is another way to stay informed as the incident's going on and as you're evacuating. And then, like I said, we took FireSafe SLO, solved the problem of all the entities all with different stuff. And so we're bringing it all together on our website. Chief Agson covered all this already, but it's good to review. Evacuation order, right? That's an order to leave. They want you to leave.
And if you leave, you're not going to be able to get back in, and it's because there's an immediate life threat. The evacuation warning, that's a warning to be prepared to evacuate. And then the shelter in place is obviously we want people to just be in sheltered and there's a life threat outside, but you're safe to be in inside. So we've talked about the ready, the set, and now this is the go, right? So you've got your plans ready. You've decided that it's time to go. This website here, Cal Fire, is a ready for wildfire.org. They have lots of checklists on what to put in your go bags. And I know Cambria was really good about the go bags with Bruce Fosbeck, I think it was, that pushed a lot of that. And what to put into your go bag. And this website here will, it's a video and it shows you exactly what to do. But, you know, the main things like prescriptions and pets, I think there was a P's. It was all P things that we were supposed to remember, but I don't remember a lot of them. But they're on the video, and there's checklists, and you can download them and get them on your phone and be ready to go for that. So the winds are, we talked about evacuation. So where, how are we going to get out of our community? We should know that. I mean, we go down these roads. In this simulation, we're looking at the what we call the Windsor plan. You call the park area. The Windsor plan, obviously, right away, one thing that stands out is it's a single egress neighborhood. There's only one way in and one way out of that place. And we've identified through the program of Lateris and just being in the area of evacuation routes to get out of your community. As OES talked about, they're reluctant to name off evacuation routes and evacuation areas. And the reason is because we don't know where the incident's going to occur, number one. We don't know what the hazard in that area is. And I can't just tell everyone to go to Shamel Park because that might be where the fire is going. And so if everyone's just automatically going to Shamel Park, that's not going to work out for us. So just being flexible and knowing that there are routes. So what we're looking at is primary egress roads out of a community. And then if we can identify those, I can then also look at opportunities for fuel reduction on those roads. I'm a planning commissioner in the city of Pismo Beach. Maybe it's that I bring up that we widen that road, that we do better road clearance around that road, because we know people are going to be setting on that road if there's an evacuation. So there's opportunities to understand that. As the person getting ready to evacuate, you just got to know the ways to get out of your house and how to get to Highway 1, right? Everyone's going either north or south out of Highway 1. And primary roads we identified here were Windsor, Cambridge, and Pembroke on this one. The Lateris program that we're working on, this is the very first time we've got to use this program on an evacuation on a community. It forecasts impact zones, it visualizes the evacuation plan, and it provides us with population density. It basically takes every house and assigns two cars to every house. And then in the simulation, it's assuming that everyone's already all packed with the car running, sitting in the driveway. And as soon as you push go on the simulation, the entire community tries to evacuate all at one time. It gives you a population density, it gives you a travel time, and it uses the road speeds and the open street map routes. It's a simulator, and we talk about models. Models are all wrong, essentially, and it depends on what data we put into it. So that's my job, of course. I get to put all the data into it and try to figure out how to make that work. Currently, this is how it came, the Windsor plan, that evacuation plan that came out, it estimated there's 603 addresses, a total population of passenger cars of 1,206. It automatically assigns, for every two vehicles, it assigns one commercial vehicle as a default. I can change that, but in this case, we came up with 301 commercial vehicles. The single worst evacuation time from the Windsor plan area is 1 hour and 8 minutes, average time of 37 minutes, and standard deviation was 13. The chart below there is, and you can't see the bottom. Oh, yeah, you can. So the graph that's at the bottom just shows if you leave at 30 minutes, you're going to have the longest wait time. That's basically what that you're going to find on there. So obviously, the earlier you leave, the faster you're going to go, the better off you're going to be, and you'll be out of the area. The in this case, this is a static. This program runs in the background, but you can see all the red roads. Everything immediately lights up as a traffic problem, right? And leading to Highway 1. And so me as the Fire Safe Council, I'm going to be looking to try to get some type of fuel reduction on both sides of this community. And so that's kind of what this programs are, these programs are for. They give us intelligence. They give me an opportunity to to make this happen again and again. I can make this happen multiple times and then report on that to the people that make the decisions and have the dollars to put that in. The SIM table is just another example of that. So basically, we're trying to learn the zones, and then what's it look like when we evacuate, and then what's it look like when there is a fire in that community, and how do we better develop a plan that assists everybody and keeps everybody as safe as possible. And so with that, it's really 10 minutes or less for my evacuation plan I was given there. So, but my name is Greg Alex. I'm on the Fire Safe Council. We're here once a month. And I definitely would encourage you to get involved with that group and bring anything in, information that you would have with that. And with that, I think we'll start moving in on the SIM table. I'm part of that cadre too, but the it's definitely awesome to be able to see how the fire will move in the community and what that looks like. And I think if I can just jump. Dave, can I just jump to them? Is there an introduction? No. So I'll introduce Dave Kay. Dave Kay has been with Cal Fire. He was a training chief. He also worked in the Emergency Command Center at the end of his career. So he's very familiar with what gets sent to this area, what responders are coming in, how they come in. And anyway, been a great friend of mine for many years. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Greg. Most of what he said is true about me. Thanks. I'm here to set the stage briefly to get into the SIM table, but I'm going to stay here with you, and we're going to focus on the screen and walk through the simulation of one of the five evacuation groups in Cambria, and it's the Windsor Plan. There's a total of five. This is one that hasn't had a whole bunch of fuel reduction done on it yet. Why are we the last ones to present? It's a perfect setup. The way the day started with this fantastic artwork in fire prevention, and then we had a conversation with the insurance man about what you need to do to get that insurance, but what you need to do with your residents. And then Chief Putney spoke about hardening your structure. This is personal work you should be doing around your house. And then two short presentations on evacuations, everything that you need to prepare for. What we're going to show you here in a minute or two is not intended to scare you. It's intended to show you what computer-generated simulations of fire, given weather, fuel, and topography, any given day of the year. The scenario we chose is for late summer, early fall. What kind of wind pattern happens about that time of year? Anyone? Santa Ana's, John Lindsay likes to call them Santa Lucia. And I actually called people in Switzerland and got the answer. Phone winds are actually fern winds. There's no R in the word, though. My name's Dave. You don't pronounce it Mike. But anyway, the fern winds are east. Again, thank you. Take 20 out of petty cash for that. East winds in San Luis Obispo County, and not just San Luis Obispo County, but all up and down the western, between the Intermountain West and the coast, create this fire hazard. Again, we're not here to scare you. We're here to show you the potential of this specific area. You've already seen the evacuation scenario. Quickly, I was asked to make this presentation because clearly, based on the group out back there, I'm the most photogenic, hands down. But I'd like to introduce Doug Forrest, who brings, show your hand, he brings 30-plus years of resource and vegetation management planning for the entire southern state of California, his whole career. That's the kind of stuff we're putting into this. Thanks, Doug. Nate Herring and I worked together for 30 years with CAL FIRE, and we generally get along still. There's a lot of stories, most of which are true. He's bringing that knowledge into the coordinator of our group. You met Greg. He and I worked together for a long time under the same roof at the Los Osos Training Center. All of those stories are true if they come out. John Aguilera, we're trying to wrangle as an IT spec. Throw your hand up there, bearded wonder. Another 30 year. I'm introducing you to some of my closest friends, just to let you know. And moving along to Baxter Boyington, who is the focus group coordinator for the Fire Safe Council here in San Luis. There's 9 focus groups in San Luis County, and he coordinates all of them. Busy man. But he wrote this scenario we're going to present to you now. Before we get started, are there any questions about anything I've talked about kind of fast? Again, I'm going to stay here and focus on the screen. We're not going to go over to the table. The sim table, anybody with military history in the room here? Anyone? You remember the sand tables? In State Fire Service, all the guys I introduced you to, we started with sand tables. And it's a true story that the person that carried the little toy airplane that walked around the table before technology had V8 juice in his mouth. Guess that what that was used for?
A retardant drop.
Things have changed a little bit since then. That table over there is a fantastic tool to use in a small focus group environment or a training class where you can put all the students around that table and each student is a different resource responding to that incident. What we're going to do in a larger group is I'm going to walk you through what you're seeing, why you're seeing it, and because of technology, we can actually stop the fire. Now, in every fire Greg and all these guys have been to, they've all gone out. Every single one of them over the span of 35 years. That was sort of a joke, thank you. We're going to stop the progression of the fire briefly just to get you caught up on what you're looking at and offer up a little bit of information. So with that said, Baxter, are we ready? Let's light this candle. He's going to start a fire right across Highway 1 from where we're sitting right now at the base of it's the Windsor track, but it's Park Hill track, but it's the Windsor evacuation zone. We have ignition? That's what I'm going to do, yeah. Here's the original start. We're working out the technical glitch with the program. Okay. He's gonna restart it. The fire's gonna start right at below these homes. Good thinking. Appreciate that. So the time is right down here at the bottom. Baxter, if you could call out the time every once in a while. 6 minutes in. And stop. So did you see, you saw where the fire started. Do you see that little finger taken off right now? That's the training that goes into why we do this with engine companies. We need to be able to forecast what fuel type change is happening. Is there a topographic change? What caused that to jump out like that? Because that's what's going to start carrying the fire up into the residences. Before we go any further, this is one of the handouts that you saw out on the table. I'm here to tell you that after 30 plus years in the fire service, it's not just wordsmithing or word speak, structures, your residences are a fuel type. It's kind of a new concept. And it doesn't just take a wildland fire to get into your residences. How about a vehicle fire on a windy day in your garage? Would your house on a windy day start fires with your neighbor's homes? So it doesn't have to be wildfire generated. It's an urban interface problem. Okay. Kick it up. That's a view I haven't seen yet in my experience here. It's actually coming in. Start it. Okay, here we go. See how it's spreading? Is that vegetation or house-to-house ignition? With maybe a tiny bit of landscape vegetation? You bet.
We're at 12 minutes.
Now, stop it. Baxter, please. What's going on in that 12 minutes? I can't stand next to this thing. Sorry. What's going on in that 12 minutes as you are just figuring out what's going on? What's coming in? What are we doing? Thank you. Very good. On any given October day, a high-level dispatch from CAL FIRE, which is dispatching most all the resources coming anyway, not just CAL FIRE, you're going to get an air attack supervisor and the small plane orbiting high, two air tankers and a helicopter. This is all happening in that 12 minutes. You're going to get a battalion chief, five engines, two bulldozers, two hand crews, and maybe a water tender. A lot of equipment coming in. That's just coming from the state mission of CAL FIRE. Now, is Cambria Fire going to be on scene? You bet. Is Station 10 going to be there initial attack? You bet. How about Cayucas, the new station, and Cayucas City? They're all coming this way. The reason I say that is to get you thinking. All that heavy iron's coming in. What are you trying to do? Get out. Does that compound the situation? Now let's talk about, let's let this run just a little bit more. Go ahead, Baxter. So now it's getting into the neighborhood proper.
15 minutes.
15. Have they?
18
say that
minutes.
Again louder, please. Theoretically, yes. That's what's happening. All that stuff's coming in, and the Sheriff's Department and CAL FIRE Dispatch is working on reverse 911 to let you folks know that this is coming.
21 minutes.
21 minutes in. Okay. Just look at it. Just check it out for a minute. Things are rolling.
25 minutes. 7 acres burned.
You see how it's coming to a point? Does that show you which way the wind's blowing? Now, back to the evacuation routes. This is a scary part of this. I know we're not
30 minutes
area. What's the way out? All the way up Windsor to Highway 1. Will that cause problems? How are we going to fix that? Well, I'm telling you straight up, we're working on it right now.
35 minutes.
Stop it for a sec, Baxter. I just had a really good question come up. What about the ranch? When I worked at Cuesta Camp 25 years ago, we were doing preparations on, it's called the East-West Ranch still, right? It used to be Fiscalini. It's Fiscalini's place, but it's being identified as East-West. It's Fiscalini now. Used to be East-West. Thank you.
Shows how I'm only 27 years old. But.
There's the access road right there. In all good faith, can we drive you people through open vegetation to get out? Absolutely not. Say again? So there's also one down there. that has locked gates. Will those gates be opened somehow? Anybody got any bolt cutters? I'm not saying that's, we're not, it's not being, but if you have to get out, that's how you're going to get out. Is it open now?
Yes.
Okay. I just heard this morning that it wasn't. So, okay. So there is egress out that way. But is that sending you through the ranch as well? Oh, I didn't mean to set that up that way, but it happened. Do we want you driving through open vegetation? Do we? Greg?
And you don't really want to drive across the ranch into the other side of town evacuated and be at the back,
and be at the back of the line. Where's Greg? Yeah. Any evacuation discussions, have they gone on with this lower piece?
No. So we talked about doing, thanks, Dave. Sure. We talked about, there's a evacuation plan that was done in around 2010. It talks about the park as a shelter in place. And I'm not sure where Shamble Park is, but Shamble Park is one, and then the beach at the bottom of Windsor, right, at the very bottom. So we were telling people that if they couldn't get out, they could go to that location. And again, that will be set at the moment of the fire, I guess. So again, there's a lot of open. That's why we're doing these simulations, so we could bring everyone together to talk about these things. But yeah, so that was the plan, was a shelter in place in locations if you could not get out.
Thanks, Greg. Yes. As an emergency.
Ingress and egress for public safety and also for people to get out. And most of the time, I don't know currently, but most of the time, because of the sewer lift stations and there's a hydrant out there for helicopters to land to refill if they can't pick up the engine, they fuel mediate along that road. So rather than be stuck in the middle of 80s,
right there is what you're talking about. The sewer treatment plant?
At the very bottom, great, left corner right there.
Okay, gotcha. 14. Okay. As you guys can and gals can hear, I spent my life running in. Evacuating is not my expertise, but we're really trying to work on how to get people in and out of this specific area. Again, there's five evacuation zones in Cambria. This is just one, and we want everybody to be as safe as possible in both ingress and egress. And again, like Greg said, that's why we're doing this focus group, is to work that through. Is there, Chief, is there anything predicating that as an egress?
That would be probably more up to the CSC. Okay. And if they made any changes since then, we did, we had to sell it to the Coastal Commission to get approval.
Gotcha.
The county approved it, the Cal Fire approved it, the state model, and the Coastal Commission said there's a need for citizens to be able to get out, both if the bridge is washed out on Windsor and if there's a fire there. So it's.
Let me send that over to the Chief. Gotcha. My apologies, the Chief. Cambria, is there a representative here?
Hey, Dave.
Yes.
One thing about this is this, I want to remind everybody, this is a fire front moving through with no ember propagation. You're not seeing any embers jumping out in front, starting new fires, which would have already happened well before at this point in the fire. You already have multiple spots where the you have new starts from embers.
And what's the time on this one? 37 minutes.
So I definitely agree. I heard the question. It was basically, it takes 25 minutes for us to even figure out if we're going to. Correct. So I would recommend going along the road, staying on the road and getting out on Windsor would be what I unless you were told to go to the beach. Maybe. So, yeah, no, I don't have much of the solution there. It's still quite a ways. Windsor would still be open. We would have people still pushing out Windsor. We absolutely would be pushing everybody out that way.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Also help us with what Facebook or any of the social media, a page where we can have all of that, or even somebody here helping us to sign up for Reverse 911, mm-hmm. doing some of that stuff, I think would be super, super helpful. That's a lot of information. But unless I have it in my hand, I go, which thing was I supposed to look at?
That's great feedback. And so firesafeslow.org, go there. Everything is there. firesafeslow.org.
Yeah, and if you want more help, okay, you can contact me or anybody in the FireSafe focus group. Of course not. But I'll give you my information at the end of the thing, right? All right? And you can contact me and we will get somebody to get you the information that you need.
And like somebody that can come to my neighborhood.
Yes, I will do that, and Chief Putney will do that. In a heartbeat. Okay? Okay, so did you sign up for the email? Then you're going to get an email from me. And when you get that, you can ask me to do anything you want. Okay? Good.
And real quick. Additionally, the chief and I are here once a month at the Vets Hall for a period of almost 11 hours. And the chief sits with us here for another 4 hours. If there is any confusion about any of this, chief is here one day a month, and he's always available at the fire station.
It's not just one day a month. I'm here all the time.
At the Vets Hall one day a month.
The Vets Hall, correct.
Vets Hall one day a month. And then he's always available, as am I.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Fire Chief Mike Berkey. Thank you guys for being here, and I really appreciate this. Is such a great turnout, and I've been in the background watching this whole thing, and I'm just astonished at all the great questions and all of the great information that's being provided to you guys. So I really appreciate it. So to kind of piggyback on to General Manager McElhaney's statements, I am always available. So my phone number, my contact information, as well as I'm at the firehouse. Is on the CCSD website, so please go there, and all of my information's on there. You can always contact me. I am more than willing. By the way, we have, Matt, if you can show the sign there, we have the magnets out over there, so I am fully ready to have every individual come over to me, and I'll sign your zone today. And we do that every time we're down at, we're also down at the Vets Hall, like General Manager McElhaney mentioned. For any of this information, if you need it, please come down. It's very difficult for me. I drive around the neighborhoods all the time, and I'm talking to the citizens, but it's very difficult for me to reach out to every single person unless you come to me, and I can provide you that assistance. So all of the information is like I said, great, and we're more than willing to help you guys on an individual basis and do whatever we can to get you guys prepared, okay? I think there were some questions regarding this, or were they answered?
Under what conditions do you open up the road, the Windsor Trail?
I'm just going to blanketly state under an emergency situation, right? We're not going to open that, and I know that's a kind of a but it really does, and I think a lot of our presentation, a lot of our presenters have mentioned this, but it really does come down to the event that's occurring at this time. We can't give you guys every single time, take this route, every single time, go that way. It's just not possible. Fires don't react that way. Emergencies don't react that way. We're here to try and give you as much preparation as we can, but nothing is going to be definite. Nothing's going to be absolute. So we have to be able to, there are tons of information out there, again, from today's presentation that will prepare you, but nothing is going to be absolute. Nothing's going to be 100%. And so that's, I think, the really important message that we need to drive home today is that you guys, everybody is their own safety officer. we need, we're trying to empower you to do the right thing to help us. And because we just don't have, no community in the world has the ability to do every single thing all the time. So we really want to make sure and prevent every emergency. And, you know, we're just trying to do the best we can. And so that's what this entire presentation is here for. And I hope you guys are kind of, you know, getting that message. So to answer that question, again, like I said, in this scenario that they're running right now, it still, even through this scenario, it's still going to be dependent on real life, real time dynamic changes that are going on. Because we could tell one thing, you know, 1 minute, and the wind changes and everything, and now we're doing something different. So it's a very dynamic situation. These things are not, again, not absolute. So
we'll continue running the simulation.
Yes.
somebody was mentioning about going to the ocean or staying along the beaches. Does that make any kind of sense?
I missed the beginning. Or you're asking if that's something you can do? Absolutely. And that we're working on, we've got a, this is a, again, this is a process that we're working on. Where there are areas, if you're in our community, you probably are aware of them. And again, it's not going to be a definite every time go down to the beach, go down, you know, go down Ardith, you know, take that route every time. But there are safe refuge areas that are down there. And they're being, updated constantly, so we just have to make sure that we're going to the website, following all of the information there.
Would it make sense, I'm just throwing it out, is if you went to the beaches, then you could be evacuated from the beaches, rather than try to go through all this fire and try to get onto these roads.
Those are always viable options, for sure. Yeah, I mean, in a perfect world, sure. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I we're always open. I mean, like I said, trying to get down to the beach, and it's going to be very dependent on the situation that's at hand. So we can't predict every situation. But again, this is why we're trying to be prepared and give you that information ahead of time, and then know your area and know your. Yeah, correct. And so that's where we have plan A, plan B, plan C, contingency plans in place. So we know that hopefully we can get everybody to the safe spot. And then there's always that option again of sheltering in place. And that's where that home hardening, everything that we've been going through all day. Yeah. I know we had another question. No. Okay. Okay. Potentially, correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Are there types of dwellings that you can put on your property that you could get into that would protect you from a fire?
So he's asking if there's dwellings or any sort of protection structures that you can put on your property that's going to protect you from a wildfire. The short answer to that is no, other than your home itself. That's why we really want to focus on hardening your home and doing those protective measures ahead of time. So short answer, I'm not going to take up any more of your time. Continue with this scenario here. Thank you guys so much for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chief. You clearly saw it's not my place to tell you what and where and how. That's your fire chief's duty. However, it is not our place to tell you based on a scenario. Sure, I'm speaking now, but can we bring the scenario back up? It's completely dependent upon what the fire's doing, where it's going, how fast it's traveling. Where's that information going to come to you from? Where are you going to get that information? Radio, reverse 911, what else? Genesis, what else? Pulse point? Those are the indicators or telltales of what and how you're supposed to evacuate. What do we got for time, Baxter?
We're at 1 hour and 2 minutes.
How many acres?
25 acres.
25 acres.
And
say again? And yes. So we do have the technology to drop spot fires in here. It's just we're learning this program every bit as much as we're learning how to present it to you. But yes, Ember Cast is another way. Total simulation. Great questions. Appreciate it. At this point, I'm going to stop the simulation and entertain any closing questions. Closing for the program today and closing for this program. Oh, we do? Sorry about that.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. But first, I promised you the raffle, didn't I? So, Greg, don't walk away.
All right, I'm in.
We'll be back to
you.
I need help here. All right, we have another Mady Mays. $20 gift certificate. 4130236. Nope. Oh, what the heck? 4130247.
They got one.
All right.
Bingo.
Bingo. I need Debbie. Red Moose. Who's got a good metabolism out there? 4130337. Red Moose Cookies. 4130241. Yeah, people walked away and didn't give you their tickets. That's 4130283. All right, I got two tickets to the Art and Wine Festival coming up in January. 4130319. Oh, you. A winner. All right. Wine tasting at Kutz Rosola. I have a hard time with that one. 4130306.
Yo.
All right. Another complimentary tasting for two. Luigi's Pizza.
Yeah. That one, wait. That one.
4130330. 333 2 3 3 2 3 3 2 3 3 2 3 3 2 2 9 1 2 9 1 3 4 4 3 4 4 325. All right, Gordon. No, no. Another Luigi's. 250. No? 266.
Yo.
All right, 266. Another wine tasting. 335. About 328. 328.
Wait, we got 328.
328. All right. Very good. All right.
I need the bird. Went back in.
I need the bird out. This is a cat carrier. All right. Who has a cat? Yes, it's an emergency bag for your cat. All right, so hopefully this goes to somebody with a cat.
Yeah, right. Here we go.
257. 257? No. 279. 279. 285.
Yo.
All right, the winner. All right. Last.
Oh, the bird out.
Our last item here is a authentic birdhouse, right? These are worth thousands of dollars. Ask Richard Lee himself. He'll tell you. 249. 249. 303. 303. 303. No. 282. 282. All right, the winner. All right. Thank you all very much. Now we have one more presenter real quick who's going to show us some of the work that's being done around Cambria. Very important. I'm not doing that. All right, Spencer, are you there? You got him? All right, a couple other things while we're waiting for Spencer. Yes, you will all get an email from me if you signed up for an email, and I'll briefly let you know, summarize what's going on, also let you know how you can get in touch with me, how you can get in touch with, if you want a local in your neighborhood coffee or something like that, some kind of a presentation, both Chief Putney and I have very willing to do those at any time that you want to get it together. If you belong to an organization and you want us to come speak in front of the organization, we will do that. We've been in front of the Lions and a lot of other groups in town, so we're more than willing to do that and get you all the information that you need, okay, and want. So we'll do it individually if that's what it takes, one by one.
We want to get Dave, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now, Spencer. Good. All right. You go ahead, and I'll move the slides for you. Spencer Gordon is with the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Resource Conservation District, and he's going to talk about some forest health projects that are going on. He is a project manager for them and is doing a lot of great work. Go ahead, Spencer.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, everybody, for hanging out and making it to the last presentation. I'll try and make this short and sweet. So like Dave said, my name is Spencer Gordon. I'm a project manager for the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Resource Conservation District. And today I'm going to talk about forest health grants and wildfire prevention grants and projects, as well as forest management plans in our region. So first off, I want to begin by acknowledging that we're on traditional territory of indigenous groups who are the original stewards of the forest on the Central Coast and beyond. And it's important to acknowledge the historical displacement of indigenous people and how it has resulted in a disruption of cultural management techniques. I encourage everyone here to support indigenous-led initiatives so we can work together to best manage our forests for their health, safety, and longevity. Go ahead, Dave. So this is a handful of the partners that are working together. So I just wanted to acknowledge that it really does take a small village to fund, plan, and implement forest health practices. There's a lot of critical players in our region working together to reach the shared vision of a safe and healthy forest. So I just want to extend my thank you to the partners and collaborators thus far for your work and dedication as we strive towards a way to protect our forests. And I just want to give a special thanks to the Cambria Fire Safe Council and Dave for organizing this event. Go ahead, Dave. So a lot of the projects I'm going to be discussing are actually managed by the Fire Safe Council. Therefore, I'm not an expert on them, but I will tell you what I know. And if you have any questions that I can't answer, I'll be sure to direct them to the Executive Director of the Fire Safe Council. So I'm going to go through the projects in more or less chronological order as they were planned and permitted, and in some cases actually implemented. So it's important to note that the following projects are funded through the CAL FIRE Wildfire Prevention Grants, and the funds from these grants were used to plan and permit, and in some cases implement portions of the project. Now, the Fire Safe Council was recently awarded a forest health grant, and that will be used to implement the permitted projects, and I'll touch more on that later. But for now, this is Covell. So Covell Ranch, it's managed by the Fire Safe Council, like I said. There's a shaded fuel break component along Bridge Street. Beyond the shaded fuel break, most of what's happening is thinning and chipping. And this is a cool project. It's rather large, 665 acres. And it's the first project of its kind in this area, particularly because of the permitting pathway. And the Fire Safe Council, their ability to utilize the California Vegetation Treatment Program, which is a CAL FIRE program, and a pathway to permit these larger projects in the coastal zone particularly. So all the projects I'm going to be talking about are in the coastal zone, and they're designated as environmentally sensitive habitat area by the Coastal Act. So a lot of these projects, all these projects, we have to work really closely with the Coastal Commission to ensure all the avoidance measures are in place to minimize impacts on sensitive species. This project was started in 2022. It's about halfway done. And if you go out, it is private property, but if you go out towards a cemetery on any given day, you'll hear some machinery out there. And it's slotted to continue until it's finished. Go ahead, Dave. So this is Rancho Marino Reserve. I can talk all day about this project because I am managing this project. It's 180 acres permitted for treatment. There's only 44 slotted to be treated in the first phase. This is on a property that's it's privately owned, but it's leased through UC Santa Barbara Reserve. And it's, the project is managed by the RCD. This is also funded through a CAL FIRE Wildfire Prevention Grant. And so the gist of this, you can see that top left corner, that red polygon, that is right along Randall Road. And so that right there is a shaded fuel break. The dotted line that intersects that polygon is the access road to Camp Ocean Pines. So it's one road in, one road out. So right now we just started on April 30th. We had crews come in and do some selective thinning and chipping on that upper slope, or I guess that'd be the southern end of the, yeah, right in that zone of the shaded fuel break. And they're going to come back in a couple of weeks and finish it off. After that, we have these, you see the pink and blue kind of strips. Those are little buffer, fuel reduction buffer zones. So on the right-hand side, that is bordering Strawberry Canyon. And on the left-hand side, that the pink strip, it goes across, or it surrounds, I should say, Camp Ocean Pines. So that's a 100-foot buffer. We're going to be doing fuel reduction in there. And the two polygons on the inside, the big yellow polygons, we're going to be doing ecological restoration in there. It's going to look like a lot of thinning and pile burning. So that's what's slotted for that project. Like I said, it's underway. If anybody has questions on that, they can reach out to me directly. Go ahead, Dave. So this one was permitted at the same time as the Rancho Marino property. So this is the Cambria Pines Ecological Reserve. Down at the bottom of the polygon is the Fog's End. It's Fog's End, what is it, Dave? It's like a bed and breakfast, an old bed and breakfast.
Yes, bed and breakfast, right at the junction of where the road to the high school goes off. Santa Rosa goes off that way.
Right. Yeah. So this is managed by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. It's a pretty beautiful property. There's Monterey pine. There's a good representation of coastal prairie and chaparral that's kind of interdispersed throughout the property. They are slotted to begin work in 2025. And you can't really tell from this picture, but Covell Ranch is actually bordering this property where the cursor is right now. So that's a good little chunk that is going to be connected right there. So go ahead, Dave. So moving on, San Simeon Point, this is a pretty complex project right here. It took about 2 years to get the permits in place. It's about 80 acres. It's on the Hearst Corporation property. It's a project managed by the Fire Safe Council using funds from the Wildfire Prevention Grant from CAL FIRE. There's a historical building on this property. There's also eucalyptus stands that host overwintering monarchs. So the Fire Safe Council is working closely with the Xerces Society, who are leading experts in monarchs, to enhance the habitat of the monarchs, as well as balance the objectives of forest health and wildfire prevention. So it's a bit tricky. You have something?
Yeah, the Hearst wine tasting area, okay, and Sebastian's is right in here, okay, to give you an idea of where we're talking about. And this is the beach, and this is the path that you're allowed to walk up now. And all this area back in here is just loaded with fuel for a fire. And in fact, there has been some fires out there by people camping illegally. And so the Hearst people are very interested and getting this taken care of so that it doesn't spread through to these buildings here, which are the historic original San Simeon, right?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Dave. Work for this one is coming up soon. It should happen this summer. So, and like Dave said, it's a public access trail right there. So where most of all of these projects essentially are not open to the public, this one is. So if you want to go out there and check it out, I encourage you to do so. Okay, go ahead. Pico Creek, it's also on the Hearst Corporation property. This is a pretty large swath, 300 acres, managed by the Fire Safe Council as well, funded by the Wildfire Prevention Grant. Work for this one is slotted to begin in 2024. There might be a couple very small broadcast test burns out there once they can get it to a point to where it's safe enough to do so. So that one is a really great stand. There's a ton of fuel out there. It's particularly messy. So it's really great that we're going to get going on that one. So go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, so the new San Simeon town is right here, okay? So you get a perspective of where that is.
Thanks. So yeah, Fiscalini Ranch. So now I'm going to kind of transition into the newly acquired Forest Health Grant. So if you recall, this grant is for shovel-ready projects. So the part of the application process to get this Forest Health Grant, we had to have projects that had all of the planning and permitting in place, which is a huge obstacle. So a lot of the properties that we have, the planning and permitting in place, the Forest Health Grant will come in and provide funding to either do initial treatments or do follow-up maintenance treatments. So Fiscalini is going to get is slotted to have some work done. It'll likely be thinning, a combination of chipping, pile burning. There's also going to be sections where they're going to be planting Monterey pines where they existed historically in areas that are appropriate for that. There might be some diversity understory species planting through another grant that the RCD is managing, as well as invasive weed removal out there. I'm not sure exactly when that will start, but it is, we received the funding for it, so to be determined. So this is a really neat map. It shows all of the planned, permitted, and funded projects in the Cambrian San Simeon region. And it really emphasizes the collaborative effort. You can see the yellow is state parks, the turquoise at the bottom is Rancho Marino, and then we've got the orangish ones as the Hearst property, and then the dashed ones as a combination of Fire Safe Council and CDFW. So it's really just it's a great map. It's a great visual to see the brevity of work that's going to be done and that has already began in our region. And with all of these properties that are going to be worked on, it comes up to be roughly 90% of the Monterey pine stand in Slo County. So it's a pretty substantial grant that we just got in that's going to really propel us forward in being able to manage a lot of our forests. Go ahead, Dave. So I'm going to transition a little bit towards more of the planning that's on the horizon. So the RCD received funding to develop a number of forest management plans, including updating a region-wide forest management plan. So if you look on the left, that's a forest management plan that was developed in 2002, and that was a region-wide forest management plan for the Cambria-San Simeon area. And obviously since then, a lot of environmental conditions have changed and management has really ramped up. So the idea is that we're going to create an updated forest management plan that will serve as a roadmap to guide management and maintenance of Monterey pines in the stands that have been treated as well as those that have not. And that is slotted to begin work on that in the fall. That will probably take, you know, I would say at least 6 months to a year to completion. But we're going to have a lot of, it's going to be a collaborative effort to develop that. And then there's also another type of forest management plan. It's called a cooperative forest management plan. So in addition to the region-wide, the RCD is developing a number of cooperative forest management plans for smaller parcels. And the cooperative forest management plan shown on the right here, it checks the box on various cost share opportunities for private landowners. So if you own a parcel and you're interested in forest management, the RCD has funding to not only write the plan, but we also just acquired a grant with funding to implement the plan. And beyond implementation of the plan, the plan itself serves as a document to be eligible to receive further funding through government programs to maintain your parcels. So if anybody's interested in that, they can reach out to me personally or call the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Resource Conservation District office, and we can work something out like that with that. We're currently doing one for Strawberry Canyon right now. I've got a lot. I got a couple going on in North County in Oak Woodlands. They're typically easier to do outside of the coastal zone, which I know isn't the Cambria San Simeon region. But if anybody's outside of the coastal zone, it's just a quicker, easier process to implement the project because the permitting is a lot less complex outside of the coastal zone. So that's pretty much it. Dave, you want to go on to the next one? Just one more shout out to all of the project partners that have collaborated and helped us along the way. And that's the end of my presentation. If you want to go to the last slide, and I'm happy to take questions if there's any.
Yes, we do have a question. Hold on.
Oh, yes. My concern is with the eucalyptus trees. I know they're oil-based trees right out to the leaves, and they're fire hazards. They've caused a lot of fire problems, and even in the native land of Australia. Mm-hmm. So they're not native to this country at all. Are you doing anything maybe in the future to cover that?
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. I did a grad program at Cal Poly, and my project was doing a fuel load analysis in eucalyptus at Montana de Oro. So I'm totally on board. Beyond fire hazards, they cause a slew of ecologically harmful. They're just not great for the environment. However, monarchs have taken a liking to them, and it has been documented that monarchs will overwinter on different types of trees in the absence of eucalyptus. But there is a large affinity towards monarchs, not just in our region, but across the state. So it is a delicate balance of selectively thinning out the eucalyptus stand and reducing those fuel hazards, but keeping enough around to be able to host monarchs as well. So that is, there's a lot of discussion with the Xerces Society. I would reach out to those folks if you have any further questions on exactly how they're managing that. I haven't had to deal with that myself. I was part of the state parks crew that was doing the thinning at Montana de Oro. So my background is kind of, we would hold off certain swaths and we wouldn't touch them for the monarchs. But there's, 350 acres of eucalyptus out there. So taking out some of it wouldn't be detrimental. Whereas at San Simeon Point, it's a pretty small stand and it's pretty, from what I understand, pretty active with monarchs. So yeah, I totally hear you. And that's just there's just a lot of considerations to take into play when managing these sensitive systems like that. So I hope that kind of answered your question.
Yes. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Spencer. Appreciate it very much.
Yep.
I know most of you are not only hungry, but exhausted. But thank you all for coming. Again, I will be sending out an email with these presentations plus other information. And if you need more information, just send me an email back and tell me what you want. And I'll do what I can. Again, thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.